You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today, of course, is a fundraiser for KPFA Radio, listener-sponsored, non-commercial here in Berkeley. I'm happy to be participating today, and I have a great guest coming on with me live in just a moment, Barbara Honecker. But first, I want to let you know what we're going to be doing. We're going to be playing the first 20 minutes of a presentation by Dr. David Ray Griffin that hasn't been heard. It's called 9/11, Why Do Bill Moyers and Robert Perry Accept Miracles? And this is really Dr. Griffin's take on the left gatekeepers. Barbara, are you with me?
I am. Hi, Bonnie.
I wanted to let everybody know, Barbara, that you're well known, but for those of you who don't know you, I'd like everyone to know that Barbara Honecker is a leading researcher and author. She held high-level positions in the federal government during the Reagan administration, including White House policy analyst. Her pioneering book, October Surprise, is the deep story behind the Iran side of the Iran-Contra scandal. Her research into what happened at the nation's military headquarters on September 11th is a three-hour video presentation, Behind the Smoke Curtain, What Happened at the Pentagon, What Didn't, and Why It Matters. Well, welcome, Barbara. Could you say,
welcome, Bonnie.
Well, wonderful to have you help me here with this fund drive, which is so very important to keep our radio station and our network on the air. I always like to remind everyone that this is a real radio station. This is not just internet radio. Could you say a few words about Dr. Griffin's presentation, 9/11, Why Do Bill Moyers and Robert Perry Accept Miracles? After all, you and I sort of came up with this DVD.
Yes. And I would like to preface it by just encouraging everyone to please support Pacifica KPFA Radio. KPFA is a crown jewel of independent public-supported radio, and Bonnie is a national treasure. So please, please call in with your support. So what we're about to hear the first, I believe, of two excerpts from is an extremely important DVD video by Professor David Ray Griffin. For those who don't remember or don't know, is literally the dean of the 9/11 Truth Movement worldwide. Professor Griffin is the author of 11 books, if you can imagine, 11 books on what really happened on 9/11 and what didn't. And he is one of my true heroes, and I know he's one of your heroes too, Bonnie. Well, what you're about to hear an excerpt from is a presentation that Professor Griffin gave at Seattle Town Hall. Now, he gave this, as I recall, in fact, I know, and I'm going to briefly tell you how I know. Professor Griffin gave this presentation at Seattle Town Hall, a professional public presentation, to a standing room only audience. It was the very first public address that he gave after literally almost dying. Professor Griffin had a number of amazing medical procedures that he miraculously survived. And it weakened him very greatly, but he came back to life. And one of the very first things, if not the first thing, he said to his wife when he came out of what amounted to a coma was, I have to get back to 9/11. I have to get back to 9/11 truth. Bring me my paper and pencil. And when he was able to stand and walk and was strong enough to give his first public address, this is the address that he gave. This is the address, and this is the content that he felt was that important. So I don't know if you would like me to give a thumbnail sketch of what it is, or if you'd like to just go into, you know, people listening to the first excerpt, and then we'll comment on it.
All right. Well, let's go ahead. We're going to play about 20 minutes. This, of course, is called 9/11, Why Do Bill Moyers and Robert Peary Accept Miracles? It's sort of also commonly known as his discussion of the late gate of the left-wing gatekeepers. So, Erica, let's get started.
A few people from the beginning started saying that the official account of the attacks, according to which they were carried out by foreign Muslims in other countries, was false, and that 9/11 was an inside job carried out by people and agencies in our own government. An emerging movement to make this case came to be called the 9/11 Truth Movement. This movement argued from the beginning that 9/11 was a false flag attack designed to allow the Bush-Cheney administration and its Pentagon to attack Afghanistan and then Iraq. But most of the traditional anti-war journalists, such as Noam Chomsky, George Monbiot, Norman Solomon, and Matt Taibbi, along with the writers at Counterpunch, In These Times, The Nation, Mother Jones, The Progressive, and Democracy Now!, did not endorse the 9/11 Truth Movement. Most of them, in fact, attacked it. In the first years, to be sure, we did not have a very impressive membership, as our movement had few professionals in the relevant disciplines, such as physics, architecture, and engineering. But in 2005, physics professor Stephen Jones started explaining why the World Trade Center buildings could not have come down without explosives. Due to some books and coverage by C-SPAN, professional organizations began to form, including Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. By now, we have a dozen professional organizations, including Firefighters for 9/11 Truth, Intelligence Officers for 9/11 Truth, Journalists for 9/11 Truth, Medical Professionals for 9/11 Truth, Military Officers for 9/11 Truth, Political Leaders for 9/11 Truth, Religious Leaders for 9/11 Truth, Scientists for 9/11 Truth, and Veterans for 9/11 Truth. The 9/11 Truth Movement is now very impressive in both size and professional membership. Nevertheless, the traditional anti-war leadership has continued to distance itself from the 9/11 movement. There have been a few notable exceptions, including Richard Falk and former CIA analysts Bill Christensen and Ray McGovern. But most of the anti-war leaders have maintained the stance they took in the first years after 9/11, in spite of all the changes in the 9/11 Truth Movement in the intervening years. For example, when I was interviewed on Democracy Now! In 2004, the main argument against my position was that I could not name one structural engineering expert who said it is not feasible that the planes caused the towers to come down. The movement's lack of architects and engineers at that stage constituted a persuasive argument. But now there are 1,500 members of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth who say it is not feasible that the planes caused the towers to go down. So one would suppose that Democracy Now! Would have reassessed its position, but it has not. Progressive journalists in general have not availed themselves of the evidence provided by the 9/11 Truth Movement to argue against the legitimacy of the so-called war on terror. If any major journalist could have been expected to do so, it would have been Bill Moyers. Moyers began his public life by working for President Lyndon Johnson, ending up as the White House press secretary. But having become increasingly opposed to Johnson's war in Vietnam, Moyers resigned in 1966. Next, becoming the publisher of Newsday, Moyers turned this conservative paper into a progressive organ, which in 5 years won 33 journalistic awards, including 2 Pulitzer Prizes. Then, after a brief stint at CBS, Moyers spent most of the rest of his professional life at PBS, producing and writing the Bill Moyers Journal. In these programs, Moyers argued that democracy cannot coexist with a permanent war state. His 2007 program on the secret government exposed ways in which presidents have deceived the people to promote war. And another 2007 program, Buying the War, showed that the media, instead of exposing truths that could have prevented the war in Iraq, served as cheerleaders. However, while driving home the fact that the media failed to expose Saddam Hussein's lack of weapons of mass destruction, Moyers failed to expose Osama bin Laden's lack of responsibility for the 9/11 attacks. And then in 2011, he attacked the 9/11 truth movement. After criticizing Rush Limbaugh and Fox News for providing disinformation that undermines the truth needed for democratic self-government, Moyers added, "Disinformation is not unique to the right. Like other journalists, I have been the object of malevolent assaults from the 9/11 truthers for not reporting their airtight case, proving that the Bush administration conspired to bring about the attacks on the World Trade Center." In speaking about this airtight case, Moyers was, of course, using sarcasm, considering this case anything but airtight. In fact, he said that the truthers, having no real evidence, simply cherry-picked a few supposed anomalies to build an inside job storyline. In criticizing this case, Moyers was paraphrasing an independent journalist, Robert Perry, who said, "Lacking any real evidence, the truthers have built their case on alleged anomalies in the collapse of the buildings." And drawing on Perry, Moyers appealed to one of the best of the independent journalists. Having helped to reveal the Iran-Contra affair, and having been the first journalist to report Oliver North's involvement, Perry received the George Polk Award for Journalism in 1984 and was a finalist for a Pulitzer the following year. In 1995, having resigned from both the Associated Press and Newsweek because they put brakes on stories he wanted to report, he created Consortium News, the first online magazine of investigative journalism. What distinguishes Perry's project from the mass media's cyber ventures, Norman Solomon wrote, is his passionate belief that journalism has a responsibility to follow the trail of the truth wherever it leads. In 2004, explaining the motivation behind Consortium News, Perry wrote, "The ConsortiumNews.com website was meant to be a home for important, well-reported stories that weren't welcome in the conventional, wisdom-driven national news media. I was distressed by the silliness that had pervaded American journalism by the mid-1990s. I feared, too, that the decline of the U.S. press corps foreshadowed disasters that would come when journalists failed to alert the public from impending dangers." In concluding that 2004 essay, Perry said, "The fight for honest information is a battle for the future of American democracy." Given Perry's commitments, we would have expected him to expose the truth about 9/11. And there's still another reason why we should have expected this. After Perry had won his awards for reporting about the Iran-Contra affair, he delved more deeply into this story, finding evidence to support the theory that the Reagan-Bush administration's contact with the Iranian government of Ayatollah Khomeini had begun years earlier, during the 1980 presidential campaign. President Jimmy Carter was trying to negotiate the release of U.S. citizens being held hostages by the Iranian government. The Republicans reportedly feared that Carter would arrange an October surprise, a last-minute release of the hostages, which would guarantee Carter's re-election. But Perry moved toward the theory that the Reagan-Bush campaign had worked out a different October surprise, according to which the Iranians, in exchange for weapons for their war with Iraq, would hold the hostages until after the elections, thereby virtually guaranteeing victory by the Republicans. This theory had been argued in a 1989 book entitled October Surprise by Barbara Honegger, who had worked in the Reagan White House until she resigned for reasons of conscience in 1983. But Perry publicly endorsed this view only after he had investigated the claims for himself, uncovering additional evidence. Having left Newsweek in 1990 after it insisted that Perry quit reporting about Iran-Contra, he was approached by PBS's Frontline to do a special about the October Surprises allegations. Perry knew his career would be improved if he joined other journalists in debunking the charge that the Reagan-Bush ticket had won the election by means of a dirty trick. However, finding multiple testimonies that George Bush, then the Republican vice presidential candidate, and Bill Casey, the Republican campaign chairman, met with Iranians in Madrid and Paris in 1980. His 1991 Frontline program, which came the same week as a New York Times op-ed by Iranian expert Gary Sick, led to a congressional investigation. But these allegations were widely denounced in the press, and Democratic Congressman Lee Hamilton, who headed the Congressional Task Force, declared that the theory of a secret deal had no credible evidence. In reality, there was a lot of evidence. The brother of Iranian banker Cyrus Hashimi said that he and his brother had met with Casey in Madrid on July 27 and 28, 1980. And testimony that Bush and Casey had met with Iranian officials was provided by former Iranian President Bani Sadr, by Russian intelligence, and by the biographer of France's chief of intelligence. However, Hamilton and his chief counsel, Lawrence Barcella, hid some of this evidence and disputed the rest of it by means of false claims and ludicrous alibis. For example, Newsweek and the New Republic declared that Casey could not have been in Madrid on July 27 and 28 because he was at a historical conference in London. The press declared this evidence proved the October surprise to be a myth. However, the attendance sheet for this London conference, Perry discovered, showed that Casey did not arrive until 4 p.m. on the 28th. So he could have had meetings in Madrid on July 27 and 28, as the witnesses had testified. Although Newsweek and the New Republic, confronted with this disproof of their claim, refused to print retractions, Lee Hamilton simply sought a better alibi for Casey. His task force claimed that from July 25 to 27, Casey had been at the Bohemian Grove near San Francisco, after which he flew overnight to London in time to arrive at the historical conference by 4 p.m. on the 28th. However, documentary evidence showed that Casey attended the Bohemian Grove in August, not in July. Hamilton's task force, nevertheless, stuck with the Bohemian Grove alibi. One task force member, Democratic Representative Merv Dimily, recognized the absurdity of the alibis and planned to dissent. But Hamilton used threats to get him to remain silent. So the task force's report was accepted without dissent. Hamilton then wrote a New York Times op-ed entitled Case Closed, in which he stated that the task force's findings should put the controversy to rest once and for all. Consequently, Perry wrote, Washington's conventional wisdom quickly solidified around the judgment that the October surprise story was a loony conspiracy theory. However, in spite of this conventional wisdom, Perry did not recant. Indeed, he founded ConsortiumNews.com in large part because of new documents that put the history of the 1980s in a new light, showing especially that the Reagan-Bush team had won the presidency in 1980 by virtue of a dirty trick that bordered on treason. But the press continued to hold, Perry wrote, that the October surprise story was a bogus conspiracy theory, despite the fact that many of the same Reagan figures had been caught lying about the secret Iran-Contra guns for hostages negotiations in 1985 and 86. Perry's continuing insistence on the truth and importance of the October surprise, wrote a sympathetic journalist in 1996, has made him persona non grata in the media establishment. Perry himself said, "It used to be that you were admired if you took on a tough story. Now you're portrayed as a nut." Given Perry's commitment to truthful journalism, combined with his awareness that the October surprise became relegated to the status of bogus conspiracy theory only because of lying politicians and careless and dishonest journalists, we would have expected him to engage in meticulous reporting about the 9/11 truth movement's descent from the official story about the 9/11 attacks. We would have expected him to be suspicious of the official account because it was provided by the Bush-Cheney administration, which is now known to have lied about Iraq. And we would have expected Perry to be even more suspicious about the official story of 9/11 because the chief of the lying politicians in the October surprise case, Lee Hamilton, served as the Democratic co-chair of the 9/11 Commission. Moreover, Perry could have learned in a book on the commission by New York Times writer Philip Sheehan that Hamilton's duplicitous ways continued in his new role. Hamilton, together with Republican co-chair Thomas Kane, appointed Philip Zelikow to be the commission's executive director, even though Zelikow was essentially a member of the Bush White House. Hamilton also, with Kane, concealed from the staff the fact that Zelikow had written a detailed outline of the commission's final report, complete with chapter headings, subheadings, and sub-subheadings, before the staff even had its first meeting. For all of these reasons, we would have expected Perry, as well as Moyers, to have done good reporting about the 9/11 attacks. They instead used bad reporting to attack the 9/11 truth movement's claims that 9/11 was an inside job. Both Moyers and Perry, as we saw earlier, said that the truthers had rejected the official account of 9/11 on the basis of alleged or supposed anomalies. Anomalies, coming from the word nomos, refers to occurrences that are exceptions to the norms, rules, or regularities. In saying that the 9/11 truth movement speaks of supposed or alleged anomalies in the collapse of the World Trade Center, Moyers and Perry were saying that the official account, according to which the buildings were brought down by the airliners and the resulting fires, contained no real anomalies, no exceptions to the regularities of physics and chemistry, no miracles. In truth, the official account of the destruction of the World Trade Center contains many anomalies, and some of them are so obviously and violently contrary to the laws of science that they must be called miracles. Insofar as Moyers and Perry endorse the official account of the destruction of the World Trade Center, they accept all of these miracles. I will point out six of them. First.
You are listening to the voice of Dr. David Ray Griffin, author of 11 books on September 11th, and emeritus professor of philosophy of religion and theology at the Claremont School of Theology. We've just aired the beginning of our premium today, 9/11, Why Do Bill Moyers and Robert Perry Accept Miracles? It's also known as the Gatekeeper Speech. This is a 1.5-hour DVD. It's his presentation in Seattle. There's questions and answers from the audience at the very end. And where we left off there, Dr. Griffin was just about to start going into 9/11 evidence, the empirical evidence, the forensic evidence for an inside job. This 90-minute DVD, 9/11, Why Do Bill Moyers and Robert Perry Accept Miracles, is our gift to you today for a very generous tax-deductible donation to listener-sponsored KPFA Radio of $100, $100, and we would be delighted to provide you with this professionally produced DVD, one that you heard Barbara Honecker introduce as one of his most important speeches, the thing that he wanted to do immediately when coming out of a coma. 9/11, Why Do Bill Moyers and Robert Perry Accept Miracles? Please give us a call, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. Your tax-deductible donation of $100 will be happy to provide you with this very nice thank you gift. And, you know, premiums are wonderful. They're great gifts. We want everyone to have this. But, of course, the real premium is this radio station. It's your ability to tune in every day of the week and listen to content here that you're not going to hear on any other radio station. You don't have to listen to commercials. This is a very expensive operation. We need your help. Please step up to the plate. Give us a call. Donate at any amount. $25 will make you a member of KPFA for a year. Donations of any amount are gladly, we're very grateful for them. $100, and we can send you this marvelous 90-minute presentation by Dr. David Ray Griffin. 1-800-439-5732. I'm joined on the phone today by Barbara Honecker. She happens to be the author of October Surprise. And Barbara, I heard Dr. Griffin mention you in your book.
Yes, he did. And the reason for that, if it wasn't obvious, is because at the time that Professor Griffin gave this magnificent presentation at Seattle Town Hall, I had already, of course, become a major leader and researcher and activist in the 9/11 Truth Movement, who specializes and still do in the Pentagon attack. even though he's now talking about, in this piece, the World Trade Center attack. And the reason that he mentions me and my book, October Surprise, which was the first published approximately three and a half years before Robert Perry's book on October Surprise, which confirmed the October Surprise after he did his own independent research. And he courageously, to this very day, is still investigating and putting forth on his consortiumnews.com website the facts that the October Surprise actually happened, that the 1980 election was effectively stolen by the 1980 Reagan-Bush senior campaign in a secret and treasonous deal with the Ayatollah Khomeini's Iranian regime that was then holding our 52 hostages in Iran. And the reason he mentioned me in my book, October Surprise, is obviously because he is contrasting myself with Robert Perry. Because both Robert Perry and I told the truth, did the hard work, did the digging, had the courage, and still do, to tell the truth about the theft of the 1980 election by the Reagan-Bush senior campaign in the October Surprise deal with Iran. But I also tell the truth and do the hard work and go public every day of my life on the truth about 9/11 being an inside job, the absolute proof that no outside terrorist could possibly have been the true perpetrators of the attacks on the World Trade Center or the Pentagon. But Bob Perry, for truly mysterious reasons, Professor Griffin is arguing here with the facts that you're about to hear in the second excerpt. He is making the case that why is Bob Perry so good on the October Surprise, and why is he so blind on 9/11, on the forensic facts of 9/11? And this is particularly mysterious because Robert Perry, to this day, is speaking partners with none other than Ray McGovern. And Ray McGovern, as many people know, is a national hero for being a staunch anti-war activist and also telling the truth about the forensic evidence of 9/11, that the official story that we were attacked, that our country was attacked on 9/11 by outside Muslim terrorists, is a lie. It is a lie of state. Ray McGovern goes public on this, but Bob Perry, his speaking partner, refuses to accept the evidence that is hitting him between the eyes like with a 2x4.
That's right, Barbara. And I think Dr. Griffin, of course, is using Robert Perry as an example because he sticks out like a sore thumb. But his overall point, of course, is this is very, very pervasive. It's not just Robert Perry. It's a lot of people. And I remember from the very beginning, as I'm sure you do as well, the leadership of the anti-war movement would have nothing to do with they would not deal with the crime of September 11th. It was verboten. And I think what's one of the things that's so very important about this presentation that Dr. Griffin is giving is he is explaining how the crime of 9/11 is what facilitates the imperial wars, the long war, the war without end, the 9/11 wars. And I have...
All of these wars are still to this day based upon the false claim of who attacked America and killed almost 3,000, mostly Americans, on 9/11, still the AUMF, the Authorization for Use of Military Force, based upon the official lie of 9/11, is still to this day used to justify all of these effective 9/11 wars in the Middle East to this very day. Now, I would like people to know that when Professor Griffin mentioned that the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth at the time he gave this presentation in, at Seattle Town Hall, where the DVD and the video was made, that you are asking pledges for today. And it's a must-see by every American. At that time, there were approximately 1,500 or 1,600 professionally licensed architects and engineers who had come out demanding a new investigation of 9/11 and put their entire credibility on the line after looking at the forensic evidence and saying that the official story of how the World Trade Centers 1, 2, and 7, World Trade Center 7, not hit by any plane, were brought down by pre-placed inside the building explosives and incendiaries. Now, today, there are approximately, there are over 1,000 more architects and engineers, fully licensed, who have put their careers and their entire credibility on the line after looking at the forensic evidence and joined with architects and engineers in their petition.
Well, that's right.
Now there are 2,600 architects and engineers.
Well, that's right, and it's growing exponentially. 1-800-439-5732. We want to get some more of you on the phone to pledge to this station, to the station that brings you the kind of content you're not going to hear on any other station. This is a real radio station. We've got a very strong signal. What's so exciting about a real radio station is that people driving along in their cars that are flipping around on the radio, they run into stuff that they wouldn't necessarily find on the internet unless they were looking for it. This is so important. Your tax-deductible donation to KPFA, listener-sponsored, non-commercial, 1-800-439-5732, a $100 donation. Of course, we would be delighted to provide you with this very important presentation by Dr. David Ray Griffin, 9/11, Why Do Bill Moyers and Robert Perry Accept Miracles? Well, Barbara, well, we've had a few people call already, so I'm very excited about that because we love this support, and this is a very important programming. I'd like to thank Drew Lewis in Santa Cruz for calling in and pledging today. I'd also like to thank Chris Date up in Healdsburg, a very big supporter of KPFA. Thank you, Chris. Big thank you to Lydia Blanchard in Santa Cruz. Well, we're getting, you know, we've got that repeater station in Santa Cruz, and it sounds like it's really paying off. So thank you, Lydia. I'd also isn't that great? Yeah. I'd like to thank Jamie De Los Rios in San Jose. Thank you, Jamie. So see, we're getting a lot of response from the South Bay. You can join these people who are generously supporting Free Speech Radio, KPFA, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. You can pledge securely online at kpfa.org. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. You're listening to Guns and Butter. We come to you every week between 1 and 2 p.m. Oh, wow. Okay.
Only if you say yes now.
Thank you. Thank you. The pledge room just walked in and gave me an anonymous match of $1,000. $1,000 is on the line.
Thank you.
Isn't that fabulous? Thank you, Anonymous. And so if we can get, if we got 10 people to pledge for Dr. Griffin's DVD, we'd make that pledge of $1,000. Thank you, Anonymous. Well, Barbara, what do you think? Let's get a few people on the phone, and then we've got another almost 10-minute clip, which I'd like to play, but we may not have enough time. We'll listen to at least some of it. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. $25 makes you a member. $100 gets you this important DVD. 1-800-439-5732. Okay, Erica, let's listen to as much of this 10-minute clip as we can.
As miracles. Why would Moyers and Perry accept the official account, even though it implies miracles? One answer might be that they, like many other journalists, have accepted the official view out of fear for their reputations. But Moyers and Perry have repeatedly shown that they have the courage to stand up for truth as they see it, regardless of the consequences. So why did Perry, who was wrongly charged with making baseless accusations about the October surprise, why did he wrongly charge truthers with making unsubstantiated and bizarre claims about controlled demolitions? As we have seen, there is nothing unsubstantiated about the claims that the Twin Towers in Building 7 were brought down by means of explosives. Perry claims that scientists and engineers have provided plausible explanations for the official view. But only a handful of scientists and engineers have stated in print that they see nothing wrong with the official view, and most of them have been dependent upon the government. Remember here Upton Sinclair's famous dictum, "It is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends upon his not understanding it." By contrast, thousands of professionals, including architects, engineers, firefighters, intelligence officers, military officers, and scientists, have publicly stated that the official view cannot be true. I mentioned firefighters. 118 of the 500 members of the New York Fire Department were asked to give oral histories, to give their reports of what they experienced that day. They were not asked questions. They were just told, tell us what you experienced that day. No leading questions. 118 of them volunteered the information that they experienced what seemed to be explosives in the buildings. Perry has unfairly been called a nut because of his persistence in laying out the evidence for the October surprise. Why did he, on the basis of inadequate study, turn around and say to label the truther version of the 9/11 events nutty would seem an understatement? Moyers has done equally poor reporting about 9/11. Observing that America seems more and more unable to deal with reality, Moyers rightly said in his 211 lecture that many people inhabit a closed belief system on whose door they have hung the do not disturb sign. But Moyers' own belief system has evidently made him unable to deal with the reality revealed by the 9/11 truth movement. Moyers' bias against 9/11 truth was manifested 3 years before his 2011 statement. On February 1, 2008, in preparation for the presidential election, the Bill Moyers Journal asked viewers, "What one book do you want your next president to read?" The next week, Moyers named the three books receiving the most votes, while adding, "We detected only one organized campaign against a certain book, and we disqualified it as a result." The book in question, viewers learned the following week, was my 2007 book, Debunking 9/11 Debunking, which was the book that actually received the most votes by far. Was the alleged organized campaign the real reason why this book was disqualified? It would seem not, for three reasons. First, Moyers had not, in explaining the contest, said anything about disallowing organized campaigns. In the second place, the so-called organized campaign consisted entirely of one person writing a statement on 9/11 Blogger, saying that he suspected most members of the 9/11 Truth Movement would be recommending one of Griffin's books. He suggested that they agree on one of them, and he suggested the most recent book, Debunking 9/11 Debunking. I myself played no role in this campaign. Indeed, I did not even know about the contest until it was long over. In the third place, one of the book authors, Kim Michaels, organized a campaign on behalf of his own book, The Art of Non-War. On his website, he wrote, "Bill Moyers is asking viewers to recommend the one book that the next president of the United States should take to the White House. If you feel so inclined, please recommend The Art of Non-War." As a result, Michael's book came in third in the voting a fact that was used by the publisher to promote the book. However, the Bill Moyers Journal did not eliminate Michael's book from the competition in spite of his self-organized campaign. In justifying the exclusion of my book because of signs of an orchestrated campaign, Moyers said, "I wouldn't call it a conspiracy, but I wouldn't call it fair either. But if unfairness was the reason why my book was excluded, the Michael's book, the campaign for which could have easily been detected, should have been excluded. It would seem, therefore, that my book was excluded because Bill Moyers did not want to announce that his program had recommended my book with its claim that 9/11 was an inside job. By taking Moyers' treatment of my book in 2008, together with his 2011 attack on truthers, we can see that he, like Perry, has made charges against the 9/11 truth movement that are not justified by the empirical evidence. I have yet another question for Moyers and Perry. Given their negative characterization of people they call truthers, such as Moyers' statement that they employ sophistry and Perry's charge that they have preposterous notions, one would assume that none of their esteemed friends would have anything good to say about such people. But one of Moyer's most esteemed friends was William Sloan Coffin, who after leaving the CIA became famous as a preacher, an anti-Vietnam War activist, and a leader of the civil rights movement. Moyers interviewed Coffin in 2004, and then spoke at his funeral in 2006. Shortly before his death, Coffin wrote, "All Americans who love their country enough to dig into the facts of these critical times will be well rewarded by examining Professor Griffin's books. 9/11 truth is a very important issue with the power to bring lasting change to our country."
That's the voice of Dr. David Ray Griffin, a part of his presentation, 9/11, Why Do Bill Moyers and Robert Perry Accept Miracles, also known as the Gatekeeper Speech. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. We have like only maybe 12 minutes to go, and we have a $1,000 match that we need to make by a very generous anonymous donor, 1-800-439-5732, a $100 tax deductible donation to commercial free listener sponsored KPFA, and we would be more than delighted to provide you with this wonderful thank you gift, this 90 minute DVD, Why Do Bill Moyers and Robert Perry Accept Miracles? It sounds like Barbara Honecker's having a little static there. Is that what that was?
No, it wasn't, Bonnie.
Oh, okay. Sorry. That was something else. Sorry.
I thought it was you.
Oh, I was worried about you there, Barb. I just want to let...
I would like to make a comment if I could.
Oh, yes. Please go ahead, Barb.
Right. Well, you've just heard snippets of a magnificent DVD, a video that everyone needs to see. And also, I want to give some good news. And the good news is that after 15 years, the anti-war movement, which has foolishly made 9/11, the forensic facts of 9/11, of who really attacked our country on 9/11, literally a taboo subject, even though it is literally the root of the evil tree of all of the 9/11 wars that they claim to be against. The progressive movement in this country holds an annual meeting called the Left Forum. And for 15 years since the attacks of 9/11, we're approaching the 15th anniversary here in 2016, in this September, for almost 15 years, the Left Forum, which is the largest gathering of progressives in the country annually, for the first time in 15 years, they have finally accepted, they did finally accept, an explicit 9/11 truth panel at the 2016 Left Forum a few months ago. And there were two speakers who were invited to speak explicitly on 9/11 truth. I was one of them, and the other is Professor Kevin Barrett. Professor Kevin Barrett and myself finally broke through what, I don't know what you'd call it, is it the glass ceiling or the lead ceiling of the progressive anti-war movement taboo for almost 15 years to even allow discussion of the facts of 9/11, and we broke through. So, Bonnie, I'm going to send you the link to that wonderful online presentation of the 2016 Left Forum of myself and Professor Kevin Barrett. And that is the good news, that we seem to now finally, after almost 15 years, have movement in the anti-war movement towards recognizing the true root of the 9/11 war.
Well, thank you very much, Barbara. I'll try and have Tony post that on the Guns and Butter website. I think you're more of an optimist than I. I'm not holding my breath. It has been 15 years, but nevertheless, that is good news. Now,
well, maybe that's the sound we heard, you holding your breath and finally releasing it.
But we have very important business to take care of now. We've only got 8.5 minutes left. We've got a very generous match of $1,000. We need a few more people to call in with $100 tax-deductible donations to keep this kind of programming on the air, to keep KPFA healthy and up and running. This is so important. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732, a $100 tax-deductible donation. We can send you this wonderful DVD of Dr. David Ray Griffin up in Seattle. He also takes his Q&A from the audience. It's very important. Why is this subject so taboo? Because, as he points out, this is the underpinning. The crimes of 9/11 facilitate all of the imperial wars. And I would like to quote, and I've done this before, but it's such a wonderful quote from economist Michel Chosedowski, who said on Guns and Butter shortly after 9/11, he was talking about the leadership of the anti-war movement in this country, their rejection of dealing with the crimes of 9/11. He was bemoaning that. And I'll never forget, he said, it's not enough to be against war. Everyone is against war. It's necessary to expose the big lie that the war is based on. And that's a quote from Michel Chosedowski. I always like to repeat that. I think that really nails it. 1-800-439-5732. Please call in. A donation of $25 makes you a KPFA member for a year. That's very important. 1-800-439-5732. I have a few people to thank. I'd like to thank Michael Wade in San Francisco, who called in to support KPFA. Thank you, Michael. Also, a big thank you to William Henderson in Novato. Thank you, William. Thanks to Samuel McKay in Rohnert Park. Thank you. Also, thank you to Tony Keeley in San Francisco. You can join these KPFA and Guns and Butter supporters by giving us a call, 1-800-439-5732. We are under the gun with a $1,000 match. We don't want to have to be forced to offer that back. So if we could get some more people calling in, $25, $50, whatever you can afford, it's a good cause. This is a real radio station. We must keep it healthy. 1-800-439-5732. And I do want to take a few seconds to shout out and let everybody know this coming Sunday, July 31st, is the annual Petaluma Progressive Festival, the 19th annual Petaluma Progressive Festival. The Mime Troupe is going to be back this year. That's going to be on Sunday, July 31st, from noon to 5 p.m. And that is in, I think it's called Walnut Park. Yes, Walnut Park at Petaluma Boulevard South and D Street in Petaluma. Of course, I will be there, as I always am, tabling with all your favorite shows and DVDs and whatever. Come out. I'd love to talk to you. A lot of other people will be tabling there. It's a fun event. We do it every single year. That's this Sunday, the Petaluma Progressive Festival in Petaluma in Walnut Park, noon to 5. We've got a few more minutes. Barbara, any last thoughts on our great thank you gift or why people should pledge to KPFA?
Oh, absolutely, Bonnie. I just want to remind people who already know it and let your listeners know, if they don't know it, how important Bonnie's Guns and Butter and KPFA is to support. And probably the best proof of that is that it was Bonnie's program on Guns and Butter, on KPFA, interviewing Professor Griffin himself, that happened to be being listened to by none other than architect Richard Gage, San Francisco Bay Area architect and Richard Gage. He was so stunned by the forensic evidence of what he was hearing on Bonnie's own program that he had to pull to the side of the freeway to continue listening to the program, and committed then and there to dedicating his life to 9/11 truth. That's how important KPFA and Guns and Butter is. Please, please pledge.
Well, we made the match. Thank you, Barbara. Thank you for all your help. Thank you to listeners. And I've got a few more people to thank. And, you know, Barbara, that's very nice of you to bring up the fact that Richard Gage actually heard David Ray Griffin on Guns and Butter. It was the show that we did called, it was after the New York Times had sued, after there was a suit brought by the New York Times for the fire department to make public their interviews with the firemen, with the witnesses of 9/11. And yes, those were the witnesses of the demolition rings, the explosions in the towers. And when Richard Gage heard that, he told me later, he pulled over, like you said, and thought to himself, can this be true? He didn't have an idea. You know, so many people, and still are so blinded by the Western propaganda machine that it's hard to see through. It's hard for people to accept this. And I'm glad you brought that up, Barbara, because Yara Mako once said to me, Bonnie, if we've done nothing other than launch Richard Gage, it's all been worth it. I've got a couple of minutes. Oh, I want to thank some people here for helping us make our match. Marilyn Garrett in Aptos, or Santa Cruz. I guess it's kind of the same difference there. Thank you, Marilyn. Thank you to Lucien O'Keefe in Green Beret. You can join Lucien O'Keefe and support this program, support this station, 1-800-439-5732. I'd like to thank Roy Jarl in San Francisco. Thank you, Roy. Also a big thank you to Camille Rogers in Haywood. Thank you, Camille. Linda Mesner in San Francisco. These people have called in to generously support KPFA, to support the programming we bring you here. We want to keep this station healthy. It's so very important. 1-800-439-5732. I'm so excited we made that match. That's great. $1,000 match.
Fantastic. Thank you.
That's a big one. Also, we're going to have to get off in a few seconds, but we're going to have our annual 9/11 Film Festival at the Grand Lake Theater again this year, of course. It's going to be on September 8th. That's a Thursday. It's going to be from 1 to 10 p.m. Our keynote speaker is going to be Graham McQueen. I'm very excited about that, and I'm going to have him on the show on the Wednesday before the 9/11 Film Festival, so look forward to that. And we are running our five-part with Kevin Ryan on 9/11 leading up to the anniversary of September 11th. Thank you so much. Shoot me an email at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Go to the website, gunsandbutter.org. Barbara Honaker, thank you so much. We did it.
We did it. Congratulations.
There's something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, medical researcher Robert Lustig explains the causes of America's epidemic of heart disease, obesity, and diabetes. It's not lack of exercise, it's not too much fat, it's sugar, plain and simple. And the food industry is shoveling more and more of it down our throats. I hope you'll stay tuned. It's been a dry summer here in darkest Connecticut, and a fairly cool one until last week. Perfect for bicycling. And I have leisure to do bicycling, for I am seasonally unemployed. A generation ago, a person my age would not be unemployed, but retired. But that's not what the new globalized neoliberal economy has brought us, has it? In either case, I've had some time on my hands this summer, and I've spent a lot of it bicycling. The past several years, I've bicycled maybe 200 miles a year. That's not much. This year, I'll probably go well past 1,000 miles. I'm two-thirds of the way there already. I'm now in my mid-60s, and my strength and stamina are increasing a lot slower than they used to. 30 years ago, in late July, I'd be able to bike comfortably for 60, 70 miles a day. Now, 30 miles is a good day's ride for me. Still, that's a big improvement over the recent past. I'm losing some weight, and I'm getting fitter, and my blood pressure is doing well. That's all to be expected from the exercise. Oddly, though, my taste in food is changing, too. I haven't eaten much sugar for years, but now I want it even less. I'm now less attracted to junk food, too, and I find myself skipping the Doritos and grabbing a piece of locally baked whole grain bread instead. And I'm finding more and more that I don't want to eat most of the packaged foods in the supermarket. It all tastes too salty or too sweet or both, especially too sweet. Which brings us to our speaker this week and next. Robert Lustig is a physician, a pediatric endocrinologist, and he's a medical researcher. He is a strong critic of the U.S. food processing industry and its accomplice, the United States government. In his view, America's explosion in weight, obesity, heart disease, hypertension, diabetes, and liver disease are caused primarily by the huge increase of sugar, especially fructose, that the food industry has been shoving down our throats. Fructose is poison, Lustig maintains, but sucrose, ordinary table sugar, is just about as bad. In Lustig's view, the cause of our fatness and our increased bad health is not mainly our inactivity, or salt, or too much fat, or carbohydrates in general. It is fructose. Fructose is now dirt cheap to make, and it is added to just about everything. Of course, the worst offending food is soda pop, and Americans are consuming much more of that than ever before. Fructose is added to infant formula, too, And Lustig reports a growing problem of obese six-month-old babies. I gather that Lustig's views are controversial among his fellow endocrinologists. I do think his argument is well worth a listen. My friend and fellow radio producer Robin Upton ably edited this talk by Lustig for radio. Find more of Robin at unwelcomeguests.net. Here's the first half of the talk. It's titled, Sugar, the Bitter Truth.
This story dates back about 30 years. This story has a little bit of something for everybody. It has a little bit of biochemistry, a little bit of clinical research, a little bit of public health, a little bit of politics, a little bit of racial innuendo. The only thing it's missing is sex. We can see what we can do about that, too. By the end of the story, I hope I will have debunked the last 30 years of nutrition information in America. And I would very much appreciate it if, at the end of the talk, you would tell me whether or not I was successful or not. Okay? So, in order to get you in the mood, as it were, let's start with a little quiz. What do the Atkins diet and the Japanese diet have in common? The Atkins diet, of course, is all fat, no carb. The Japanese diet's all carb, no fat. They both work. Right? So what do they share in common? They both eliminate the sugar fructose. Okay? So with that, think about what it means to be on a diet and what macronutrients you're eating and which ones you're not. And then we'll go from there and I'll try to explain how this all works. You've all heard about the obesity epidemic. Here are the numbers. These are the NHANES database body mass index. Everybody knows what that is now. Histograms, marching ever rightward as time has gone on. This was what was projected for 2008 in blue. We had so far exceeded and surpassed. This is not even funny. This was from 2003. The reason I show this is not just to show that the obese are getting obeser. Of course, that's true. But in fact, the entire curve has shifted. We all weigh 25 pounds more today than we did 25 years ago, all of us. Now, it is often said that obesity is the ultimate interaction between genetics and environment. And Dr. Christian Vase, who's sitting in the back of the room, will be talking to you next week about the genetic component, which I am also very interested in. But having said that, our genetic pool did not change in the last 30 years. But boy, oh boy, has our environment sure changed. Okay? So tonight, we're going to talk about the environment rather than genes. Okay. Now, in order to talk about the environment, we need to talk about what is obesity. And of course, you're all familiar with the basic concept of the first law of thermodynamics, which states that the total energy inside a closed system remains constant. Now, in human terms, the standard interpretation of this law is the following. If you eat it, you better burn it, or you're going to store it. Now, who here believes that? Oh, come on, you all do. Okay. I used to believe that. I don't anymore. I think that's a mistake. I think that is the biggest mistake, and that is the phenomenon I'm going to try to debunk over the course of the next hour, because I think there's another way to state the law, okay, which is much more relevant and much more to the point. Before I get there, of course, if you believe that, these are the two problems, right? Calories in, calories out. Two behaviors, right? Gluttony and sloth. After all, you see anybody on the street, oh, he's a glutton and a sloth. That's all there is to it. You know, Tommy Thompson said it on the TV show. We just eat too damn much, right? If that were the case, how did the Japanese do this? Why are they doing bariatric surgery on children at Tokyo Children's Hospital today? Why are the Chinese? Why are the Koreans? Why are the Australians? I mean, you know, all these countries who've adopted our diet all suffer now from the same problem. There's another way to state this first law. Okay? And that is, if you're going to store it, that is biochemical forces that drive energy storage, and we'll talk about what they are in a few minutes, and you expect to burn it, that is normal energy expenditure for normal quality of life, because energy expenditure and quality of life are the same thing. Things that make your energy expenditure go up make you feel good, like ephedrine, it's off the market, coffee for 2 hours, then you need another hit like me. Things that make your energy expenditure go down, like starvation, hypothyroidism, make you feel lousy. Okay? And how many calories you burn and how good you feel are synonymous. So if you're going to store it, that is an obligate weight gain set up by a biochemical process, and you expect to burn it, that is normal energy expenditure for normal quality of life, then you're going to have to eat it. And now all of a sudden, these two behaviors, the gluttony and the sloth, are actually secondary to a biochemical process, which is primary. And that's a different way to think about the process, and it also alleviates the obese person from being the perpetrator, but rather the victim, which is how obese people really feel. Because no one chooses to be obese. Certainly no child chooses to be obese. Oh, you say, oh yeah, sure, I know some adults who don't care. You know, Rossini, the famous composer, you know, La Gazza Larga, Marriage of Figaro and all that, he retired at age 37 to a lifetime of gastronomic debauchery. Okay, maybe he chose to be obese. Okay, but the kids I take care of in obesity clinic do not choose to be obese. In fact, this is the exception that proves the rule. We have an epidemic of obese six-month-olds. Now, if you want to say that it's all about diet and exercise, then you have to explain this to me. So any hypothesis that you want to proffer that explains the obesity epidemic, you've got to explain this one too. Okay? And this is not just in America, these six-month-old obese kids, but these are around the world now. Let's talk about calorie intake, because that's what today is about. We're going to talk about the energy intake side of the equation. Okay? Sure enough, we are all eating more now than we did 20 years ago. Teen boys are eating 275 calories more. American adult males are eating 187 calories more per day. American adult females are eating 335 calories more per day. No question. We're all eating more. Question is, why? How come? Because it's all there? You know what? It was there before. There's a system in our body, which you've heard about over the last couple of weeks, called leptin. Everybody heard of leptin? Okay? It's this hormone that comes from your fat cell, tells your brain, you know what? I've had enough. I don't need to eat anymore. I'm done. And I can burn energy properly. Well, you know what? If you're eating 187 or 335 calories more today than you were 20 years ago, your leptin ain't working. Because if it were, you wouldn't be doing it, whether the food was there or not. There's something wrong with our biochemical negative feedback system that normally controls energy balance. And we have to figure out what caused it and how to reverse it. And that's what tonight is about. But nonetheless, there are 275 calories we have to account for. So where are they? Are they in the fat? No, they're not in the fat. 5 grams, 45 calories out of the 275, nothing. In fact, it's all in the carbohydrate. 57 grams, 228 calories. We're all eating more carbohydrate. Now, you all know back in 1982, the American Heart Association, the American Medical Association, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture admonished us to reduce our total fat consumption from 40 to 30%. Everybody remember that? Okay, that's how Entenmann's fat-free cakes came into being. Remember that? So what happened? We've done it. 40% down to 30%. And look what's happened to the obesity, metabolic syndrome, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, cardiovascular disease, stroke prevalence, all jacked way up as our total fat consumption percent, as a percent, has gone down. It ain't the fat, people. It ain't the fat. So what is it? Well, it's the carbohydrate. Specifically, which carbohydrate? Well, beverage intake, right? 41% increase in soft drinks, 35% increase in fruit drinks, fruit aids, whatever you want to call them. Just remember, down here, one can of soda a day is 150 calories. Multiply that by 365 days a year, and then divide that by the magic number of 3,500 calories per pound. If you eat or drink 3,500 calories more than you burn, you will gain 1 pound of fat. Okay? That's the first law of thermodynamics. No argument there. That's worth 15.5 pounds of fat per year. One soda a day is 15.5 pounds per year. Now, you've all heard that before. That's not news to you. The question is, how come we don't respond? How come leptin doesn't work? How come we can't stay energy stable? That's what we're going to get to. So I call this slide very specifically the Coca-Cola conspiracy. Anybody here work for Coke? Pepsi? Okay, good. All right, so this over here, 1915, the first standardized bottle of Coca-Cola out of Atlanta. Anybody remember this bottle? Sure, a lot of you do, right? I remember this bottle because my grandfather in Brooklyn took me on Saturday afternoon down to the local soda shop on Avenue M and Ocean Avenue, and every Saturday afternoon I had one of these. I remember it very well. Now, if you drank one of those every day, assuming, of course, that the recipe hasn't changed, because, after all, only two people in the world know the recipe, and they're not allowed to fly in the plane at the same time, right? You know that. Okay. Assuming the recipe hasn't changed, if you drank one of those every day for a year, 6.5 ounces, that would be worth 8 pounds of fat per year. Okay. Now, in 1955, after World War II, and sugar became plentiful again and wasn't being rationed, we have the appearance of the 10-ounce bottle, the first one that was found in vending machines, and you probably remember that one as well. Then in 1960, the ever-ubiquitous 12-ounce can, worth 16 pounds of fat per year. And of course, today, this over here is the single unit of measure, right? 20 ounces. Anybody know how many servings are in that bottle? 2.5 8-ounce servings, that's right. Anybody know, anybody who gets 2.5 8-ounce servings out of that bottle? That's a single serving, right? Okay. So that would be worth 26 pounds of fat per year if you did that every day. And then, of course, over here we have the 7-Eleven Big K Thirst Buster, Big Gulp, whatever you want to call it, 44 ounces worth 57 pounds of fat per year. And if that wasn't bad enough, my colleague Dr. Dan Hale at the University of Texas San Antonio tells me that down there they got a Texas-size Big Gulp. 60 ounces of Coca-Cola, a Snickers bar, and a bag of Doritos, all for 99 cents. Okay, so if you did that every day for a year, that would be worth 112 pounds of fat per year. So why do I call it the Coca-Cola conspiracy? Well, what's in Coke? Caffeine, good, good. So what's caffeine? It's a mild stimulant, right? It's also a diuretic, right? Makes you pee free water. What else is in Coke? Salt. 55 milligrams of sodium per can. It's like drinking a pizza. So what happens if you take on sodium and lose free water? You get thirstier, right? So why is there so much sugar in Coke? To hide the salt. When was the last time you went to a Chinese restaurant and had sweet and sour pork? That's half soy sauce. You wouldn't eat that. Except the sugar plays a trick on your tongue. You can't even tell it's there. Everybody remember New Coke, 1985? More salt, more caffeine. They knew what they were doing. That's the smoking gun. They know. All right, so that's why it's the Coca-Cola conspiracy. So are soft drinks the cause of obesity? Well, it depends on who you ask. If you ask the scientists for the National Soft Drink Association, they'll tell you there's absolutely no association between sugar consumption and obesity. Okay? If you ask my colleague, Dr. David Ludwig, remember, I'm Lustig, he's Ludwig. Okay? He does what I do at Boston Children's Hospital. Someday we're going to open a law firm. Each additional sugared sweetened drink increase over a 19-month follow-up period in kids increased their BMI by this much and their odds-risk ratio for obesity by 60%. That's a prospective study on soft drinks and obesity. The real deal. If you look at meta-analyses, everybody know what a meta-analysis is? Okay, it's a conglomeration of numerous studies subjected to rigorous statistical analysis. 88 cross-sectional and longitudinal studies regressing soft drink consumption against energy intake, body weight, milk and calcium intake, adequate nutrition, all showing significant associations, and some of these being longitudinal. This came from Kelly Brownell's group at Yale. Okay? I should comment, disclaimer, those studies that were funded by the beverage industry showed consistently smaller effects than those that were independent. Wonder why. Now, how about the converse? What if you take the soft drinks away? So this was the fizzy drink study from Christchurch, England, James et al., British Medical Journal, where they went into schools and they took the soda machines out, okay? Just like we did here in California. We haven't seen the data yet, but they went and did it for a year. So the prevalence of obesity in the intervention school stayed absolutely constant, no change, whereas the prevalence of obesity in the control schools, where nothing changed, continued to rise over the year. Okay, so that's pretty good. How about type 2 diabetes? Are soft drinks the cause of type 2 diabetes? Well, this study from JAMA in 2004 looked at the relative risk ratio of all soft drinks, cola, fruit punch, and found a very statistically significant trend of sugared soft drinks, fruit aids, et cetera, causing type 2 diabetes. And you know we've got just as big a problem with type 2 diabetes as we do with obesity for the same reasons. And this was a sugared sweetened beverage against risk for type 2 diabetes in African-American women. Looking here at sugared sweetened soft drinks, just the downward arrow shows that there was a significant rise as the number of drinks went up. You can see that here, whereas orange and grapefruit juice, interestingly, did not. Two different studies, two different increases in type 2 diabetes relative to soft drink consumption. So what's in soft drinks? Well, in America, it's this stuff, right? High fructose corn syrup. Everybody's heard of it, right? It's been demonized, something awful. So much so that the corn refiners industry has launched a mega campaign to try to absolve high fructose corn syrup of any problems, which we'll talk about in a moment. Okay? But the bottom line is, this is something we were never exposed to before, 1975. And currently, we are consuming 63 pounds per person per year, every one of us. 63 pounds of high fructose corn syrup.
That's American.
That's American, yes. What is high fructose corn syrup? Well, you'll see in a minute. It's one glucose, one fructose. We'll talk about those at great length. One of the reasons we use high fructose corn syrup is because it's sweeter. So here's sucrose. This is cane or beet sugar, standard table sugar, you know, the white stuff, okay? And we give that an index in sweetness of 100. So here's high fructose corn syrup. It's actually sweeter. It's about 120. So you should be able to use less, right? Wrong. We use just as much. In fact, we use more. So here's lab fructose over here, if you had crystalline fructose. And they're starting to put crystalline fructose into some of the soft drinks. You can, they're actually advertising it as a good thing. And that's got a sweetness of 173. So you should be able to cut that way back, right? They're not. Lactose down here, milk sugar, it's not sweet at all. Okay? And glucose, I should point out over here, is 74. It's not particularly sweet, and we're going to get to that at the end, okay? And what goes on with glucose. All right? But anyway, there's why we use it. It's sweeter. It's also cheaper, as I'll show you. So here's high fructose corn syrup. One glucose, one fructose. Notice the glucose is a six-membered ring. The fructose is a five-membered ring. They are not the same. Believe me, they're not the same. That's what this whole talk is about, is how they're not the same. Okay? And here's sucrose, and they're just bound together by this ether linkage. We have this enzyme in our gut called sucrase. It kills that bond in 2 seconds flat, okay, and you absorb it. And basically, high fructose corn syrup, sucrose, it's a non-issue. It's a wash. They're the same. Okay? And they know that they're the same, the soft drink companies and the corn refiners, because here are their misses. Okay? This comes from the Corn Refiners Association. Obesity research shows high fructose corn syrup metabolizes and impacts satiety similar to sugar. Indeed it does. I agree. At academic meetings around the country. Okay? Hunger and satiety profiles energy intakes following ingestion of soft drinks. Bottom line, research supported by the American Beverage Institute and the Corn Refiners Association. They are correct. There is absolutely no difference between high fructose corn syrup and sucrose. So much so that the Corn Refiner Association, in an attempt to capture market share, came out with this entire ad campaign. You probably saw it on the back page of the New York Times. Okay, it was on TV. It's everywhere. My hairdresser says that sugar is healthier than high fructose corn syrup. Wow, you get your hair done by a doctor? I didn't know I could cut hair. If you all want to see all of them, there are a whole bunch of them, you can go to www.sweetsurprise.com and see how you're being hoodwinked. Okay? But indeed, this is true. High fructose corn syrup and sucrose are exactly the same. They're both equally bad. They're both poison. Okay? I said it. Poison. My charge before the end of tonight is to demonstrate that fructose is a poison. And I will do it. And you will tell me if I was successful. Nonetheless, here's Center for the Science and Public Interest and the Corn Refiners Association. Everybody remember last year when Gavin Newsom floated a soda tax? Governor Patterson of New York has since floated one, and other people are starting to talk about it. So why are they saying this? Well, they're saying obesity is a problem, kids are drinking soda, let's tax it. So they're talking about soda like it's empty calories. I'm here to tell you that it goes way beyond empty calories. The reason why this is a problem is because fructose is a poison. Okay? It's not about the calories. It's not has nothing to do with the calories. It's a poison by itself. And I'm going to show you that. Nonetheless, I just want to read you this paragraph here, okay, in yellow. We respectfully urge that the proposal be revised as soon as possible to reflect the scientific evidence that demonstrates no material differences in the health effects of high fructose corn syrup and sugar. I agree. Here's the important sentence. The real issue is that excessive consumption of any sugars may lead to health problems. Not may, does. Does. So here's the secular trend in fructose consumption over the past 100 years. Before we had food processing, we used to get our fructose from fruits and vegetables. And if we did that, today we would consume about 15 grams per day of fructose. Not sugar, fructose. Sugar would be 30 grams, it would be double. Okay, we're just talking about fructose today. Prior to World War II, we were up to about 16 to 24, about 20 grams. So a small increase from the beginning of the century to World War II. Then, in 1977, just as high fructose corn syrup was hitting the market, we had increased that. We had basically doubled up to 37 grams per day, or 8% of total caloric intake. By 1994, we were up to 55 grams of the stuff per day. Remember, if you want to do sugar, then double the number. So that's 10.2. So you can see that more and more of our caloric intake, higher percentage, is being accounted for by sugar every single year. So it's not just that we're eating more. We're eating more sugar. And for adolescents today, we're up to almost 75 grams, 12% of total caloric intake. 25% of adolescents today consume at least 15% of their calories from fructose alone. This is a disaster. An absolute unmitigated disaster. The fat's going down, the sugar's going up, and we're all getting sick. Now let me show you why. So this is where the politics comes in. This is the perfect storm, and it was created from three political winds that swirled around all at the same time. The first political wind, everything bad that ever happened in this country started with one man. So Richard Nixon, in his paranoia back in 1972, food prices were going up and down and up and down. I'm going to show you that on the next slide. Okay? And he was worried that this was actually going to cost him the election. He admonished his Secretary of Agriculture, Earl Rusty Butz, I love that name, to basically take food off the political table, to make food a non-issue in presidential elections. Well, the only way to do that was to make food cheap. So he was out to find all methods to be able to decrease the price of food. Remember Nixon's war on poverty? We're suffering from it today.
We've been listening to endocrinologist Robert Lustig with part one of Sugar, the Bitter Truth. Thanks again to Robin Upton at unwelcomeguests.net for the audio. And thank you for listening to New World Notes. We come to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUHFM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. NewWorldNotes.blogspot.com. On behalf of the entire New World Notes staff, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimi non carborundum. Support your local bike shop. Remember that war is not healthy for children and other living things. And please come back again next week. Ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
are listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear the speech by attorney and author Dr. William Pepper, given at the Left Forum in May of 2016. It's been slightly edited to fit into our time frame. The full version can be accessed on YouTube or No Lies Radio. Dr. Pepper's new book, The Plot to Kill King, provides the full truth about the conspiracy behind the King assassination. So let's begin. Here's Dr. William Pepper.
But I think it's important for us all to understand that political assassinations did not start in the 1960s, that they've been a part of human society for a very long period of time as a means of altering structures and change. So if we put all this in a context, I think it gives us a broader picture of what happened that my colleagues have been involved in researching and writing, and that I have had many ways a very depressing period of years in working on. Our moderator said I was James Ilray's lawyer for 10 years until he died. I represent the family of Martin Luther King. Martin King was a friend of mine only during the last year of his life, and I represent currently Sirhan Sirhan and work for Bob Kennedy in 1964 as a kid when I was his citizens chairman in Westchester County when he ran for Senate. I took on those cases not lightly because I knew the victims quite well, and it took me 10 years to convince myself about Ray's innocence and non-involvement. But let's look at these in a historical way. Going beyond the Sumerians, we can start in Western civilization with Socrates and the compelled assassination of Socrates. And I say it was compelled because he took his own life, so far as we know, but it was compelled. Then we can move on to Caesar, assassins that finished Caesar and changed Roman society and Roman history at that point in time. These are basic early political assassinations. And then we can come, irrespective of religion, to the man known as Jesus, who was also assassinated by power figures and structures in his own time, Orthodox and Jewish leaders, as well as Rome, whom he caused a great deal of discomfort to. And I'm one of those people who has done a fair amount of research on his life for about 17 years when he was in India, and realized that when he went from Lhasa and traversed India, the Brahmins wanted him killed. And he had to flee India and come back to his native land because he was insisting on meeting with untouchables. And he was threatening a structure that to this day exists. I have in my work the creation of a seminar on the Dalits, who are today, and for 3,500 years, have been enslaved in India as the impoverished people of that country. So we have Socrates, Caesar, Jesus, and then we can move on into the Middle Ages. We have Henry II saying, "Will no one rid me of this pesky priest?" And then two of his henchmen left, crossed over, and then assassinated Thomas à Becket, a political assassination because he was uncomfortable for the regime of Henry II. And you go on to Henry VIII, and we have Thomas More, who made him very uncomfortable. And so Thomas More had to be taken care of. So we move through history then more closer to the present time when we deal with a man called Lawrence, T.E. Lawrence. Now, Lawrence lived in a place called Clouds Hill in Dorset, and he tried to remain as anonymous as he could. But he's the one man in British history who affronted and embarrassed the King of England, who held his magnificent ribbon to decorate him after the First World War and turned his back on the king and refused to take it. Joined the tank corps ultimately, and then made up his mind that he was going back to the Middle East to deal with his beloved Arabs. But beyond that, Henry Williamson, the Scottish fascist author, brought to him a letter from Adolf Hitler, who invited him to go to Berchtesgaden, because Hitler had identified Lawrence as the one man whom the British would accept as a dictator, because he was such a national hero. So Lawrence became intolerable to the realm, and he had to be eliminated. Another political assassination, because MI5 hit him with a black mariah after he had sent a telegram to Williamson saying, come on up for tea on Tuesday. So there goes Lawrence of Arabia, as he was called by Lowell Thomas, and as we came to know him, and he was finished. So these are examples of political assassinations that one has to keep very clearly in mind, because I've come to believe that political assassination is the last resort. If they can get rid of you one way or another, diminish you, de-emphasize your work, they'll do that. Scandals, arrests, whatever, they will do that. But if they can't get rid of you that way, and you insist on challenging and become a serious threat to whatever power structure there is, then that's where assassination comes in. I'm about to turn in the later years now to what happened to Mr. Roosevelt. And I won't go into detail here, but what I have learned is staggering in terms of what really happened to Mr. Roosevelt at Warm Springs. Roosevelt had a plan of action to implement after the Second World War at the end of his days. He could not be allowed to implement that plan because it would have resulted in the indictments of Allen Dulles, John Foster Dulles, John McCloy. Go down the list of the henchmen of the forces that ruled this country. And Roosevelt was going after all of them. 30 Rockefeller Plaza, where Allen Dulles was given his rooms to work, Bill Stevenson had him wired and the entire floor wired. And they knew that Dulles, as Arthur Goldberg has said, the Dulles brothers were serious traitors and should have been tried. And Mr. Roosevelt was going after them. So we have those kinds of situations that have emerged throughout history. So without dwelling on it, I just want you to all understand that I firmly believe that, and has been, this historical use of political assassination throughout human society. And that we shouldn't be surprised with what happened in this country in the 1960s, which my colleagues are going to talk to you about. I thought when Martin was killed in 1968, they got the right guy. And they traced him, they arrested him, they tried him. I thought they got the right guy. That was 1968. I had known him only from 1967 when I came back from Vietnam as a journalist, and Ramparts published this article of mine called The Children of Vietnam. Martin was a subscriber to Ramparts. He asked to meet with me. He wept when he saw the photographs. He wept when he saw what his government was doing. That was in February of 1967. And on April 4th of 1967, he delivered his famous speech at Riverside Church, where he came out hard against the war. He then, at that point, said to me, can you stay with me and help develop a new politics movement, which I agreed. And we had a convention in Chicago with over 5,000 delegates, and we were going to launch the King-Spock ticket, which I first asked masses of people in front of the UN to consider on April 15th, 1967, 11 days after Martin delivered his speech there. How naive we were. I look back and it's almost laughable at how stupid we were, because we didn't realize the extent to which the government would infiltrate, subvert, and destroy a movement. So when the Black Caucus was founded at that convention in Chicago, and Martin was delivering the opening address, the keynote speech, a note gets passed to me over my shoulder, get him out of here, or we will take him hostage and embarrass him before the world. They had to get rid of him from that convention because he was a unifier. They had to finish it. So we had to get him out. Told Andy, we have to get him out of here in order to avoid that kind of brutal embarrassment that was being led by the Blackstone Rangers, a Chicago gang. How naive we were. So out he goes, and then that same caucus starts introducing resolutions that split the movement terribly and made sure that there would not be any effective political opposition to Lyndon Johnson. So that went on and on. And eventually, Martin decided he was going to bring 500,000 people to Washington, not to march, but to camp and to visit the Congress, their congresspeople, and try to get put back into the budget monies that were taken out of the social programs because the war needed those monies. And the military knew that he might lose control of that because they weren't going to get that money back. And there was going to be mounting frustration, and that could lead to the same type of revolutionary turmoil that the world saw in Paris not so long before that. Lyndon Johnson didn't have André Malraux, who was able to deal with de Gaulle and to co-opt that movement. But Lyndon was going to rely on the military and the police to suppress it. But they didn't have the troops. Westmoreland wanted 200,000 more. They didn't have the troops for that. They didn't have the troops to put down what they saw was going to be a serious revolution on the streets of Washington. So Martin King was assassinated because he opposed the war in Vietnam, but was hitting the bottom lines of a number of American corporations, and two, because he was going to bring this massive humanity to Washington, and that could lead to the revolution. So they made up their minds early on that he had to go. So what did they do? They profiled the Missouri State Penitentiary System, Hoover's request, and they found an ideal patsy, guy who was a con man. He was a convicted criminal who could be manipulated and controlled and used and moved around. And that, of course, was James Earl Ray. So they took James and they used him as the patsy. He escaped more than a year before the actual assassination. They moved him around the country. Martin was originally to have been killed in Los Angeles. They kept James in Los Angeles for a long time. The two military special ops guys who were the backup team did not kill him, but were the backup team, were also housed in Los Angeles for the fateful day. The problem was, as I came to realize in later years, there was another assassination going to take place in California a couple of months after Martin, and that was, of course, the assassination of Bob Kennedy. It wouldn't do to have two of those take place in the same city. So they switched around. The military guys didn't know why they were ordered to move to New Orleans and Memphis, but they were. James was moved to New Orleans and then eventually into Memphis. And Memphis, under Frank Holloman as director of police and fire, was where the assassination of Martin King was to take place. Whereas land was cleared for Bob to be hit in Los Angeles when he was, as expected, he would win the Los Angeles primary. So they set that stage very well. They gave Ray credentials. They gave him a handler. The name of the handler is a fellow called Raul. People said, oh, Raul, oh, he made this guy up. Raul was made up. Raul was a real guy. He was an operative who came out of Portugal. He worked for Portuguese intelligence in Angola. He was brought into the United States. He was given a job. He did their bidding. I was eventually able to find witnesses who knew Raul. I located where he lived. He lived in Yonkers, New York, would you believe? His name was Raul Coelho. Fairly recently, not so long ago, he died. But Raul was the handler for James and moved him around, gave him money, told him what to do. So they set all of this up. And I thought when Martin was killed, it was a lone nut. How naive, right? That's where I, my naivete stretches, I'm afraid. But I believe that they had the right guy when they got him. And I just walked away. We buried Martin. Ben Spock and I went down to Atlanta. We buried Martin. Bobby asked me to come up and to his suite and talk about handling or working on his presidential campaign. And I said, no, I was through. Finished with politics. That was it for me. I walked away. 9 years later, Abernathy and I, who talked regularly over the years, and Abernathy said, look, I'd like you to go to the prison with me and interrogate Ray. And I said, what are you, gone around the bend? He said, no. I said, do you think there's any reason why he might? He said, I don't know, but I'd like you to go. I have some uneasiness. And I didn't understand what was behind Ralph's request at that time. That's further naivete on my part. Ralph was diminishing his position in SCLC, and this was perhaps a chance for him to refurbish his own image. So I said, okay, but I don't know anything about the case. It took me 6 months to prepare. Finally, in 78, in August, we went up to the prison. I interrogated James for 5 hours with Jim Lawson and Mark Lane, who was representing James at the time, and Ralph was there. So we finished that five-hour session with a firm belief that James was not the shooter. I didn't know what role he might have played knowingly. Anyway, he wasn't the shooter. But he raised enough questions that I started in 1978, all those years ago, right? 1978, going into Memphis, quietly, on the streets, in the bars, talking to people who knew things that went on there. And more I learned, more and more questions became answered and new questions arose. And I would go visit James in prison. And he kept asking me to represent him. Mark took it as far as he could, and he left. So I said, no, I won't represent you until I'm sure you had nothing to do with this killing at all. That took 10 years, 78 to 88. Finally, I became convinced that this guy really was a patsy. Everything about him was that. So I took him on in 1988 as a client. We went to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. Having lost at the Federal District Court, went to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, and then to the Supreme Court for cert. We lost everything. We didn't have a shot at winning at all. I worked on it. I got Thames Television because I had moved to England. I moved my young family to England in 1981 because I was tired of having my four-year-old son pick up the phone and hearing threats on his father's life and asking me who those guys were on the beach and who were those two guys over there in the duck blind on the other side of the road, who every time I left, somehow their binoculars hit the sun and they were following me. This is no way to raise little kids. So I left and I went to England in 81. I became a visiting scholar at the Wilson College, Cambridge, and I kept commuting. And they had basically a peaceful life over there. I raised that first family in England. I lived there for 20 years. But the more I came back and the more I learned, the more it became evident to me that James Earl Ray was totally innocent of this crime and that somebody else was very much involved in the crime. So I did the first book in 1995, Orders to Kill, and that put forth everything that we learned up to the point of 1995, which meant the television trial that lasted for 10 days. Hickman Ewing was the prosecutor, unscripted trial, jury chosen from all over the country. It took them 7.5 hours to find Ray not guilty. I thought Hickman was going to have a heart attack. This is unheard of, right? And we had a smattering of the evidence that we eventually got, but was not guilty. Then the doors opened and more evidence and people came forth and the evidence picked up and led to James Earl Ray being met by the King family, by Dexter King. King family then coming out full-blown publicly asking for a trial for James Earl Ray. He died in 1988 in prison. We failed to get him a trial. 1999, we brought an actual civil action, went on in Memphis for 30 days, 70 witnesses that clearly up to 2003 set all the information up as to how Martin King was killed, what we knew at that point in time. It was devastating stuff. Mainstream media, of course, woefully ignores all of this. They would come in when Coretta was testifying or Dexter or Andy Young, and then they would leave when the heavy evidence and witnesses started to appear. They would just go. Court TV was nowhere to be found. Oh, they were going to televise it because they were nowhere to be found. It was not reported, not devastated. It took the jury 59 minutes after 30 days and 70 witnesses. It took them 59 minutes to find that Martin King was killed by a conspiracy involving agents of the government of the United States, state of Tennessee, and the city of Memphis. And, of course, a low-level guy whom we sued called Lloyd Jowers, who owned the grill behind which Martin was killed. And it was Jowers who took the rifle from the shooter and brought it in and broke it down in front of his lover, who finally, 30 years later, finally admitted to me exactly what had happened. And the reason she was quiet all those years, because she thought Jowers himself had been the shooter. But Jowers was the main defendant That gave us the basis for that lawsuit, you see. Okay. So I ran that story in a book called Act of State, An Act of State. That was published in 2003. And this is that book. And it put forward all of the evidence of the trial. The court reporter also put out a book called The 13th Juror. One of your colleagues here has that book. That has the whole transcript of the trial. Every bit of evidence in the trial was there. So that was 2003, right? So here we go from 1978 to 2003, and we have an enormous amount of information about how Martin King was killed. And I would have thought that's enough, but it wasn't enough, because all of a sudden, people are getting close to the grave. And if you write a book on these cases, and you do it in 3 or 4 years, and you get it out, and you sell it, you maybe make some money with some of the bravado, you may be doing a service. But if you somehow hang on to a case for 30 years or 35 years, and in this case, really, it's 38 years, and you're there, and you keep going in and out of Memphis, and you know people who never talked to you before, but all of a sudden they're getting close to dying, and they now have something to say, then more and more evidence comes out. And more evidence comes out when the son of a Dixie Mafia operative who was responsible for bringing the money in from Hoover and dispensing these funds to local people, including people like the Reverend William Samuel Billy Kiles, who died recently, and the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who's still alive, because of services they will perform for the money. And here you have this young boy. He was 8, 9, and he's there, and it's seeing Clyde Tolson. How many of you know who Clyde Tolson was? Huh? Clyde Tolson was the guy whom, as you know, Hoover's number two, Hoover's lover, Hoover's trusted confidant. It was Tolson who was the guy who came all in and out, bringing the money, working with Frank Holloman, setting everything up. So here comes these new witnesses, this new Dixie Mafia family, and the head of the family died, and now the son is that much older. And he wants to get this off his chest. So he comes to me and he tells me what happened. From his standpoint, he has a particular piece of information. He knows what happened. Because he rode with his father to the prison carrying $25,000 to the warden of the prison to organize James Earl Ray's escape after James had been profiled. And he was there, his father. And he sat in. He brought the donuts and the coffee. And he sat in. He saw all these things. And he remembered them. And he was down on Mulberry Street on a bike when Martin was shot. And Earl Clark, who was a lieutenant in the Memphis Police Department, came down over the wall and ran up the street to get into a waiting police car to take him away. But Earl Clark was not the killer of Martin King. He was the spotter. And he was there doing his job as a spotter. The killer of Martin King was the best shot on the Memphis Police Department. He was paid a fairly small amount of money. He was an ex-Vietnam vet. Brother was killed in Vietnam. He hated black people. He behaved abysmally in terms of black people in the south side of Memphis. And he was readily recruited. And I had eyewitnesses who saw him the day of the shooting practicing early morning until he left around 3 o'clock at the Memphis Armory Police Department shooting range, and he left in his buddy's car, put the rifle in the back seat, which was described to my eyewitness, who was a custodian, black custodian, as a very special gun. Off he went, and he was the guy who shot Martin King. I had lunch with him. I asked him to have lunch with me. He needs money. So he agreed to have lunch with me for $500. I paid him $500, and we had lunch. He wouldn't eat, and he sat there. And I said, you know, I have some witnesses who say, you were the shooter. This is what you did. You killed Martin King. What do you have to say to that? And he said, I don't have anything to say to that. I said, well, you know, we got 2 plaster of Paris footprints where the shooter ran back toward an alleyway. It had rained the night before, and they got these footprints. And the size of those footprints, size 13. Now tell me, Frank, what size shoe do you wear? He said, 13 large, and he had a little grin on his face. But that's as far as I got in terms of getting out of him. However, I knew another taxi driver for years, 25 years. And I said, I want you, Frank, you know who he is. He said, yeah, drives a taxi. I said, oh, yeah. Okay, I want you to just get in and confront him, see what he says. Guy got in the back of his car one day and said, hey, I hear they're going to get you. I hear you're going to be indicted. Pepper's got enough evidence on you to get you. And he said, what are they going to get me for? Something I did 30 years ago? I just blurted this out. Something I did 30 years ago? I said, oh, my goodness. So of course, we got an affidavit statement of that. But he's free. He's walking around. He still needs money. We only paid him $5,000 for the hit on Martin King. But that, in those days, seemed to be a lot of money, and he was happy to get it. So it takes us up to a point, and I can't go really much beyond that point because that's in the third book, the final book in the trilogy, which will be out on June 7th. And that book culminates in the most depressing news of all that I have, because Martin King was not killed by that bullet that he took in the head. And I can't tell you any more than that, except I have the eyewitness details of how he actually died. And that is perhaps the most depressing part of my story with respect to Martin King's death. I don't want to go into that at this point in time. So that's as much as I can tell you, one, about the history of assassinations. Political assassinations are virtually as old as human society. All the ones we had in the 60s were part and parcel. The difference is that the cover-ups that have taken place with respect to the assassination of Martin King, and of course, John Kennedy and Bob Kennedy, and I am today Sirhan's lawyer. I took on Sirhan only when I became convinced, again, that he was a patsy. And I have to tell you that the evidence against him is so much less convincing. What's happened to Sirhan is the end of the Sixth Amendment in the United States, so far as I'm concerned. We have just lost at the Ninth Circuit. We're going to the Supreme Court. But it's clear he's a political prisoner. His own lawyer was under a pending indictment and threw the case entirely. Grant Cooper threw the case, collaborated with the prosecution, made sure that Sirhan would be convicted. The difference is that Sirhan, though profiled like Ray was also subjected to mind control. And we believe we know where that took place and even who did that and how he was subjected. And that's why he has this gap. Every parole hearing I've been at with Sirhan, I've been his counsel for the last two parole hearings. He honestly does not remember a period of time after he was pinched by his handler on the neck. He doesn't remember what happened after that. But we've been able to find 12 witnesses who always saw him in front of Bob. And of course, Bobby was hit with bullets fired at powder burn range from behind, by someone kneeling down behind him. So there's no question that Sirhan did not kill Bobby. But the cover-up is there. So we had these attempts to cover up, but nothing as sophisticated as we have seen with respect to the assassinations of the 60s. I've not been involved in the John Kennedy one. I deliberately stayed away from that one. I stayed away from Malcolm, although I know the family. I stayed away from it, would not get involved, because the more you get involved in these cases, one, the more it impoverishes you personally, because there's no money to pay for any of this. And also, the more you get maligned and attacked as a conspiracy nut, no matter how much the facts are there and back you up, you get maligned as a conspiracy nut. So it's better to focus on a limited number of them. I'm sorry to say, it takes others like colleagues here and others whom you know, like Jim Douglas and people like that, who will carry forward work on the other cases. But have no illusions. Political assassination is well in the history of mankind, and you can expect more of these in the future. I spent a lot of time in Latin South America. You all know, or many of you may know, the history of Salvador Allende, Archbishop Romero. And I have to tell you, Hugo Chavez was like a brother to me. I was very close to Hugo. And I have a lot of information about how Hugo got his cancer that killed him after 18 months. And I desperately tried to get Hugo away from the Spanish doctors who came to Cuba and get him into another situation. But he was convinced that the Spanish doctors were going to take care of him. So he had chemotherapy and the radiation, which is associated with cancer treatments generally and known to fail. And of course, it failed in Hugo died. So we've had our share in this hemisphere of assassinations. They will continue. And you only can expect nothing else from a power structure that wants to control the world.
And again, you've just been listening to a speech given by Dr. William Pepper at the Left Forum in May of 2016. I highly recommend that you get a copy of his new book, The Plot to Kill King. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening. You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and myself, Mimi Rosenberg. Carl Dix has played a key role in initiating the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and along with Cornel West, collaborated in calling for a month of resistance to mass incarceration, police terror, repression, and the criminalization of a generation. And Carl joins us on the ground now in Cleveland, Ohio. Thanks for being with us, Carl Dix.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, the last image I saw, and one of the few that gave any voice to the reality that there were protests in Cleveland, showed members of the West Ohio Minutemen, a constitutional militia, with approximately a half dozen members of this group across from Public Square, taking advantage of Ohio's open carry provision to display Smith & Wesson M&P 15 rifles. Talk to us about what the environment was like, and I believe some of the confrontation of that ensued with some of these ultra right-wing proto-fascist organizations.
Yesterday was a day in the streets in Cleveland. I was out in the morning with Cornel West announcing a rally that we were going to have. Protesting murder by police is righteous, very necessary, and must continue. And then we came back in the afternoon for a protest at Public Square. And when we arrived at Public Square, an array of reactionary forces had gathered and were attempting to dominate the square and not allow any progressive protest to happen. Well, there were about a half a dozen people who were out around the Tamir Rice murder by police case that had happened in Cleveland. There were a couple of people who were trying to talk about how the Cleveland police had murdered Melissa Williams and Timothy Russell before they had murdered Tamir Rice. And in both cases, none of the police had been punished around it. One police officer was put on trial for the Melissa Williams-Timothy Russell case, but he was exonerated in what was a legal sham. The Russell Williams case, let me lay out what this is, because we didn't get video of it, but it is as outrageous as some of the videoed murders we've seen by police. Timothy Russell and Melissa Williams drove by a police department. Their car backfired. Dozens of police from several districts in Cleveland then began to chase them for 20 miles, shooting at them the whole way. Cornered them outside of Cleveland, fired more than 100 shots into their car. Then one of the cops jumped on the hood of their car and fired 15 shots in, making sure the two of them were dead. That cop was the only cop who was charged, even though this couple did nothing wrong. This cop beat the charges on two bases, according to the judge who heard his case. The first was he made a claim of fearing for his life, and the judge felt that that was a reasonable claim, even though He jumped on the car to get in the kill shot and obviously had no fear for his life. And then the other thing the judge cited is he wasn't sure that cop had fired the kill shot. This is the kind of thing that's gone on here in Cleveland, and it mirrors and concentrates what goes on around the country, and it was what we were taking to the streets to say needed to stop, and people acting to stop it should continue. But we had to confront an array of Second Amendment rights people with their guns, anti-abortion activists, anti-LGBT rights people. There was just the whole sea of them in there. And when we gathered on the corner, we decided, well, we weren't going to succeed by asking them to allow us to do our protest. We were not going to ask the state's enforcers, the police, to clear the way for us because we knew that wouldn't go anywhere either. So we just formed up. A couple dozen members of the Revolution Club had come to Cleveland and were going to be part of this protest, and they formed up and marched in, chanting the whole way, and it cowed the reactionaries and carved out a space for us. And as we marched in, we were chanting, indict, convict, send the killer cops to jail. The whole damn system is guilty as hell. We were chanting, Tamir Rice didn't have to die. We all know the reason why the whole system is guilty. We added a chant, how do we get out of this mess? Revolution, nothing less. And that carved out a space for us. In that space, Cornel West spoke on why he felt he had to come to Cleveland to be part of this protest. I spoke. We had four family members of police murder victims who spoke in Cleveland.
Carl, I'm interested in to what extent there was a kind of robust response from the people of Cleveland to the protests that were occurring. Of course, many of which were organized by people from Cleveland and their leadership itself. But to what extent was the lockdown of the city a preventer for people being involved? Or, on the other hand, what was the response from the Cleveland community, which is so overarchingly poor and really needs to rise above the federal poverty guidelines, etc.? Talk about that.
There has been a very heavy police presence. Before the convention, the FBI visited anybody they could find who had expressed publicly that they were going to protest. There had been all kinds of media about how heavy-handed the police were going to be, how they were going to keep everything under control. And they have brought in police from all over the country. We saw police from Utah, Texas, Indiana, North Carolina, from Michigan State, in addition to all of the police in Cleveland and police from throughout Ohio who have flocked into the city. And they're attempting to control like every step taken by any grouping of protesters. And it has had a chilling effect. But then at the same time, there have been things that have broken through that. Like on the first day, on Monday night, the march that the newly formed musical group, the Prophets of Rage, led after a rally that they had done, a free concert in a park in Cleveland. 1,000 people marched from the concert site down to the convention center in downtown Cleveland under the theme of End Poverty Now. It brought together a number of local groups that had been working on various issues around poverty and police abuse. That was actually a very good sign. But what has characterized the convention has been the heavy police presence. Even for our protest yesterday, there were people who came to it who, once we marched in and carved out the space for it, the police threw up a line of cops on foot, and then a line of bicycle cops, and they made it very difficult for people to get into the rally and participate in it. Cornel West had to pass through three different police lines to get to the rally that he had co-issued the call for with me. That's how stringent it was. We held the spot for an hour, and then we marched through downtown Cleveland. deciding that we had confronted the reactionaries and the cops long enough. There were people who wanted to march with us who the police wouldn't allow through the lines, but then what developed was two protests marching down the street with a line of cops in between it, and then we finally were able to get past the police lines and bring the protests together into one. But there has been that heavy police presence. Also, in downtown Cleveland, there has been a flood of reactionaries promoting all kinds of vicious, anti-progressive people and, frankly, anti-humanity stuff in general. You've had the Westboro Baptist Church talking about God hates LGBT people, but that's not the terminology they use. You have, like, rolling displays that charge that Planned Parenthood sells aborted body parts of fetuses. All this kind of stuff is all over the place. It's a sickening sea. It's a sea that we went into and parted, if I can use a biblical reference, with a strong stand that police murder must stop. And we were able to open up some space in it, but it was a fight to do so. And that sea, plus all of the cops, we're seeing to it that that sea has sway, because they didn't have cops circling them and trying to push them out of the square and keep them from spewing their reactionary nonsense. But we were right in the face of the cops the moment we marched in and had to fight to continue to get in and hold the space, and then decided, let's just pull out of here and let's take it through Cleveland. That was very necessary because the theme of this convention has been channeled from Hitler and Mussolini of a law and order that is literally fascist, clamped down, that takes the crimes this system has already carried out and promises to expand them and intensify them. And Giuliani laid that out very clearly when he said that Trump is going to take what he did in New York City and do it in the entire nation, an intensifying police clampdown, specifically targeting Black and Latino people all across the country. And then he put the world on notice. He said, we are coming to get you. This is what this convention holds for the people of this country, but also the people of the world. And then I just have to set that against the message of the Democratic National Convention, because let's admit, the crimes of this system have not eased off during the Obama presidency. They've continued. Record numbers of deportations, continuing brutality and wanton murder by police targeting Black and Latino people, rollbacks of the right of women to choose to have an abortion, continued wars for empire and destruction of the planet. That's why we say that we should not be voting for this system. We should be working to overthrow it.
Carl, we're going to have to end it there and move on. We urge you to stay safe in that militarized environment that has a considerable number.
Okay, thank you for having me on. And just one brief point. Go to the website revcom.us. We're having daily reports from the convention, and people can find out about the protests and other things that have happened.
We've been speaking with Carl Dix, and always on the case and always championing the issue of the working class. Carl Dix has played a major role in initiating the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. Thank you, Carl. To bring some love and get here today. Picket lines and picket signs. Punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see. Oh, what's going on? What's going on? Yeah, what's going on? Oh, what's going on? And we're joined from Cleveland, Ohio, by Abbas Hamad, a prominent Palestinian activist, co-founder of Al Auda, the Palestinian Right to Return Coalition, and Cleveland resident. Abbas, thank you for joining us. What are some of the issues for Cleveland's Muslim population and related concerns that were expressed in response to the positions of and the RNC convening in Cleveland, Ohio?
It's a great pleasure being on with you. The Muslim community is currently experiencing difficult Islamophobic sentiments. The latest incident was with Avon, Ohio Police Department, as the whole world witnessed a response to a desk clerk at the Marriott Hotel in Avon, Ohio, where the front desk person contacted the police, and she said that this person who was dressed in Arab garb was pledging allegiance to ISIS. The police responded to that notion, and understandably so, came to the hotel and took the man down at gunpoint. They humiliated him. They took him to the ground, not knowing the case that he was simply a person who was at the Cleveland Clinic Hospital for treatment. So that was the latest incident that happened in Cleveland, Ohio, in reference to the Muslim community. We were obviously outraged at this. We had a conference call with CARE, Council on Islamic Relations. Cleveland media was out there. And obviously the rest of the world, as you've probably seen online, it went pretty viral across the internet. So the whole world witnessed a Muslim man who was coming to the Cleveland area for treatment from the United Arab Emirates. He was harshly treated for simply going into a hotel and looking for a room. So imagine that, someone dressing in traditional garb goes into a hotel looking for a room to sleep for the night, who happens to be in the area, treated very harshly. Because of the current Islamophobic climate in America, with candidates like Donald Trump calling for Muslims to be banned from the United States, even deporting Muslims, and obviously you know that the Muslims are not the only one targeted by American candidates, which is a shame. Donald Trump in particular was targeting Mexicans, he was targeting African Americans, even women, demeaning women, humiliating women, and all the way up to humiliating people with mental disabilities. So that shows you what kind of America we're headed towards. And he says he wants to make America great. Actually, it's the other way around. So that's the recent climate in Cleveland. That's probably the most popular thing that happened with Islamophobia. And we're still working on that. And we're still helping the gentleman with some of the Muslim leaders in the community with the help of CARE and other organizations. Of course, that was only one. That was a highlight. That was something that happened that was popularized by the internet, it went viral, but there are a lot of other things that go on as well.
Familiarize us more about what's going on from the ground up in Cleveland in that respect, and then I want you to tell us about the demonstration that happened around this and issues from the Black Lives Matter community.
Sure, absolutely. Other things that happen are, of course, there's a rise in people basically disrespecting the Muslim women that wear the hijab, which is the Muslim garb, or the traditional Muslim clothing that they wear with the veil. Of course, you also have some of the community, not many, but we also have women who dress the entire face down. They're even treated more harshly. They get threats, they get harassed by ongoers, in particular with white supremacists, you know, who are close to the area, who happen to travel in and out of Cleveland. You have areas in the Cleveland area, in the suburbs, who are more racist than others, for instance, more than the urban areas inside of Cleveland, which is, we have a greater mix, obviously. And we feel that the residents are more friendly towards Muslims. The makeup of Cleveland should understand the traditional Arab dress or the traditional Muslim dress, the religious people who choose to dress that way, because the Cleveland Clinic is central here. It's very popular. We have people that come all the way from Saudi Arabia to get treatment all the time. So this is something that you would think should be understood, that should be something that's normal. So when things happen like that, it is a shame. It only happens when you have candidates or when you have people like Donald Trump who constantly have this anti-Islamic mantra. And this is why it's growing. Without that, you hear about these incidents once in a while. But as soon as you have people who fuel Islamophobia, which is a disease, it is a fear of Muslim people, then you get more backlash in the community.
Abbas, with the RNC conversion in Cleveland, can you get a mm-hmm. sentiment of the feeling of welcoming or what the sentiment is outside of the Muslim community, but the Muslim community as well, as to its mm-hmm. its receptivity? What's its feeling about this entity and the politics that it represents? What's your general sense of the community's response?
The community at large, the people like us, the people like you and I who are fighting injustice everywhere, okay, had this sentiment about the Republican Party coming into Cleveland. First of all, we feel that it is a shame that the city of Cleveland accepted the Republican convention to come here. I understand they probably have previous coordination with parties to come into different cities, but we really didn't want it, especially at this time with the height of Islamophobia, because that's what the Republican Party unfortunately represents. They represent Islamophobia at its peak. It's not just Donald Trump, it's the entire party. If you were following the candidates, all of them were basically saying hateful things towards Muslims. So we feel more hatred, of course, that it's being held here, because what it is they're having an Islamophobic fest or a racist festival in Cleveland. That's what the Republican Party is having in a nutshell. By them being here, they've heightened these sentiments towards the Muslim community in particular, also the blacks, because they are supremacist in nature. You know, they are very far to the right. They don't like black people. They don't like minorities, period. They claim they do, but they really don't. So by coming here, that's what the community is feeling. That's what our Muslim community, our Arab community, our black community, our Latino community, that's what we feel. And they are here to basically put on their hate fest. Not only that, they have brought people from the outside, groups and organizations like Bikers for Trump, who have come all the way from Arizona, who have come all the way from across the country with their motorcycles, with their open carry guns, because the state of Ohio has a law that states that people can openly carry. We can have anyone here who has a legal right to purchase a firearm. They can come down with their AK-47s. They can come down with their long weapons. They can have their guns out in the open. They don't even have to conceal it. It's legal to do that. I understand that the law enforcement officials had a problem with that, and they were asking these protesters who were basically against Muslims not to do that, but I don't think that was the case. So they did come into Cleveland, and that's what they're coming with. And obviously, some people in the community are fearful of this. They're fearful of these people. They're coming in to Cleveland with their guns in the name of protecting Donald Trump. Imagine that. So they're here to protect Donald Trump, who has security measures from the United States Secret Service, security measures from the state police. He has police all the way from California, all the way from Texas, who have come to Cleveland, and they're sworn in for the week for the Republican National Convention. So he also needs these white supremacists, okay, which is basically an arm of the KKK, to come down to Cleveland, and they have this need that they want to protect Trump. Boy, they can't even go anywhere near the convention, but they're all over Cleveland hanging out with their motorcycles, scaring the hell out of Muslims.
What's the police presence like?
The police presence is like I've never seen before. I understand there's a need for security. There's a need to protect the public, and I respect that. As a human being, I respect that. As an activist, and I respect that in general. We should be safe. We should feel safe. The only thing is, with our protests, we protested Trump, as you know, thousands converged to Cleveland from all over the country. Some people you know yourself as well, who have, like Sarah Flounders from the International Action Center, came over. You have Workers' World, different organizations came, like Code Pink, who always show up to these major rallies. So we're grateful to have these people. But the presence of the police was not friendly, if you will. You know, they had their masks on, they had their gear on, they looked like robots. They had these shoulder pads, these knee pads, obviously with their weapons and guns, and that's understandable. But there is a sentiment of not feeling at ease. I mean, this is a peaceful protest, and I understand their argument is because of the recent police shootings, which is very unfortunate. Obviously, we don't support that at all, and we actually stood in solidarity with those innocent police officers who have been killed. But the presence is tough. It really is not friendly towards peaceful ralliers who are coming to make a point against Donald Trump, who are protesting hate, to see these police officers all over the place at the rally in particular. I can understand if they're spread out, if they're throughout the city, they want to protect the people, you know, that's all fine and dandy. We are supportive of safety measures. We're not against safety. But seeing their presence,
let me also ask you,
can be intimidating to some people.
I had reports that people throughout the course of the week had actually received visits from the FBI and who families of various activists who were subject to an enormous amount of harassment pursuant to protest activity that was going to be taking place around the convening of the RNC. Do you have any information about that?
Yes, we've actually seen that in the papers, and my friends were concerned about that because I've had FBI visits in the past myself for pro-Palestine rallies. For instance, protesting Coach Blatt of, you know, or former coach of the Cleveland Cavaliers, when he brought the so-called IDF, which are obviously killing Palestinian people, they wanted to honor them. So they came and visited me, and my friends were concerned and sent me the link. I've seen the link all over Facebook. And we also have a friend. Her name is Maggie Rice. She is actually an activist, a peaceful activist who works with an organization called Food Not Bombs. They basically feed the ralliers who come to these protests. He had a permit for this rally to feed the people. Imagine that. And they feed everybody, not just the activists. Anybody who wants food, they would feed. She had a visit from the FBI questioning her about the rallies and stuff. So these are people we know within the community. And these are friendly people. These are very peaceful people who support justice. For the FBI to do that, I really think it's uncalled for. I don't even know if that's legal. That's intimidation. And that's something that's always strange about the FBI. They're always interviewing and visiting the wrong people. You know, they could be visiting AIPAC, for instance, or AIPAC supporters who literally support the killing of innocent children in occupied Palestine. And I told them that to their faces many times. That's who they need to visit. That's what the country's FBI should be about, protecting American interests, not harassing people who are doing their job. Ralliers are doing the FBI job because we want the true betterment of America. And that's why we're out in the streets. We want to protect American interests, the real interests, not one side over the other.
And how many
so
groups,
the FBI
Abbas,
is an organization that's always finicky when it comes to these things.
And Abbas, just give us, as we wind up this segment, and thank you for being with us from Cleveland, Ohio, just give us a one-minute description of the demonstration that took place where you played a prominent role, where the issues of Black Lives Matter were raised. Describe it for us.
The level of respect that this national rally in Cleveland against Donald Trump and against the Republican National Convention was phenomenal. I've received phone calls, text messages, emails telling me that we want you to be there. We want you to speak. And I did. And we want you to be front and center. We want to represent Palestine at the front. They went on and on. I received so much support because, as you know, in this particular rally, I was not an organizer. I was a supporter. They told me, we don't want you to just be a supporter. We want you to be at the front lines. And that's exactly what happened. When I was there at the rally, they told me, no, you need to come at the front and you need to hold the leading banner with the Palestinian flag. And that's what I did. And I led some chants throughout the entire rally. I spoke a few times on the microphone and I stood in solidarity with our sisters and brothers who stand against injustice. We stand with Black Lives Matter. And I made that clear at the demonstration. The Palestinian people support black people in America, as you know, from Ferguson to Missouri to Baton Rouge, as far as, against this injustice against black people. We stand in solidarity. We made that clear at the rally. It was phenomenal. I mean, you could not understand how proud I felt with Palestine echoing throughout the streets of Cleveland. You had to be there to really understand that. And especially as a Palestinian, it was something that was very, very honorable.
And we're going to have to move on. And we want to thank Abbas Hamad, who's been with us, the prominent Palestinian activist, co-founder of Al-Auda, the Palestinian Right to Return Coalition, giving us that description of what's been happening in the community with the Muslim, with the Palestinian community. And they're organizing in response to the RNC and their incredibly Islamophobic, anti-Palestinian perspectives. Abbas, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next.
This Way Out.
Preston wanted me to apply for the Advisory Council on Faith-Based and Neighborhood Initiatives, and it's just really important for the trans community at this particular point in time to have that kind of visibility.
I associate the term lazy with the person who was an activist lying in the streets in 1990 and then realizing, like, well, do I really have time to go to that protest? It's not someone who doesn't care anymore. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's someone who's gotten comfortable.
Now I'm fascinated.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Canadian Anglicans defiantly bless marriage equality, faith-fortified trans activist advises Obama, and midlife and lost love as seen through a lazy eye. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Jessica Andrea.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending July 16th, 2016. A narrow vote by more than 200 delegates attending the triennial six-day General Synod 2016 of the Anglican Church of Canada this week would allow their ministers to bless the unions of same-gender couples in church ceremonies. Initial reports had the resolution failing by one vote, but after several delegates complained of voting irregularities, a recount revealed that it had passed, although just barely. Both the bishops and lay delegates had voted to support the resolution by 68% and 72%, respectively, but the original result showed only 66.23% of clergy in support, literally one vote short of the required two-thirds majority. When the votes were recounted, however, it was discovered that General Secretary Michael Thompson's vote had been counted as a lay vote instead of clergy. The reversal made it the one additional vote needed to pass the resolution. According to the Canadian press, about 1.6 million Canadians identify themselves as Anglican, which claims about 2,800 congregations across the country.
The resolution still needs to be reaffirmed at the next synod of the Canadian wing of the Global Anglican Communion in 2019 before it becomes official church law. Civil marriage has been open to gay and lesbian couples in the country since 2005. But the vast majority of Anglican officials in what's called the Global South, Latin America, Africa, and Asia, are staunchly opposed to LGBT rights and are bound to pressure their Canadian counterparts to reverse the vote in 2019. Earlier this year, Anglicans punished the Episcopal Church, the U.S. wing of the Communion, after it voted to allow its ministers to officiate the weddings of same-gender couples. The theological Anglican divide over the inclusion of LGBT people in church life has, for the past several years, threatened to tear the Communion apart.
Civil marriage equality continues to be a hot topic in Bermuda. Lawmakers in the independent British Overseas Territories House of Assembly passed a bill to constitutionally ban same-gender couples from getting married earlier in the week. But their counterparts in the Senate rejected the proposal a few days later. The amendment to the Human Rights Act would have stated that none of its provisions can override the Matrimonial Causes Act, which defines civil marriage as exclusively heterosexual. The bill was strongly criticized by the country's Human Rights Commission. Bermuda's Royal Gazette newspaper quoted one senator as calling the bill an attempt to degrade human rights rather than affirm them, and said it paralleled historic discrimination against black people. Voters in the mostly conservative Christian country rejected both civil unions and civil marriage for lesbian and gay couples last month by almost 2-to-1 margins in a non-binding referendum. Only 47% of eligible voters participated, however, and a 50% plus one majority was required for the referendum to have any real impact.
Elsewhere, the U.S. Republican National Convention runs July 18th through 21st in Cleveland, Ohio. Along with the party's expected official nomination of Donald Trump for president, The platform committee has settled on what many critics are calling the most regressive anti-LGBT document in decades. It maintains a strict husband and wife definition of marriage, specifically calls for a constitutional amendment to overturn the June 2015 U.S. Supreme Court marriage equality decision, and says that only judges who respect traditional family values should be appointed to the bench. The platform also supports state laws regulating which bathrooms transgender people are allowed to use, says that parents have the right to pursue so-called conversion therapy to force their LGBT children to be straight and narrow, and demands that religious belief guide the passage of all legislation because man-made law must be consistent with God-given natural rights.
The party platform also declares pornography to be a public health crisis, opposes gun control legislation, endorses Donald Trump's call for the erection of an anti-immigrant wall between the U.S. and Mexico, and describes coal as a clean energy source. The platform committee rejected a proposal to condemn discrimination based on sexual orientation.
In what seemed like a direct slap in the face by the convention hosts, however, the Cleveland City Council passed an ordinance on July 15th that allows trans people to use sex-segregated public facilities, such as bathrooms and locker rooms, which correspond to their gender identity.
Florida Democrat Corrine Brown introduced a resolution in the U.S. House of Representatives more than 2 weeks ago condemning the horrific acts of terrorism and hatred in Orlando and expressing support and prayers for all those impacted. Such resolutions have sadly become routine after deadly attacks like the one at the Pulse nightclub. LGBT activists waited in vain for a resolution to honor the victims of that massacre. But a committee in the GOP-dominated House held hearings on a so-called federal religious freedom bill on July 12, the one-month anniversary of the deadly attack in Orlando. Called the First Amendment Defense Act, it would prohibit the federal government from taking discriminatory action against a person or business with religious beliefs or moral convictions that define marriage as a union between a man and a woman. Equality advocates charge that it would also allow businesses to withhold benefits from LGBT employees, to deny time off to an employee to care for an ailing same-gender spouse, and permit housing discrimination against gay and lesbian couples. Its supporters claim that freedom of religion is under attack in the United States. Congress is currently on a 7-week summer recess.
Meanwhile, the National Basketball Association remains undecided about moving its February 2017 All-Star Game out of Charlotte, North Carolina, because of the state's notorious HB2. The law forbids local governments in the Tar Heel State from protecting their LGBT citizens from discrimination and requires trans people to use sex-segregated public facilities such as bathrooms that match the gender on their birth certificate. NBA Commissioner Adam Silver told reporters this week that the league's team owners discussed but did not vote on the issue. He said they realize, however, that a decision needs to be made soon. Silver said he was personally disappointed that North Carolina lawmakers didn't make necessary changes to HB2 before they adjourned to make discussion about moving the All-Star Game unnecessary. He reiterated that the law, as it currently exists, is inconsistent with the core values of the league.
A college basketball game has already fallen victim to HB2. The men's team of the Durham, North Carolina-based Duke University Blue Devils was scheduled to host the Albany Great Danes on November 12th as part of the Hall of Fame tip-off tournament. A spokeswoman for the State University of New York system that includes Albany says that the game won't be played, however, because of New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's executive order banning state-funded, non-essential travel to North Carolina. Other governors and a number of city officials around the country have also shown their contempt for HB2 with similar travel bans.
In other news, the Gloucester County, Virginia School Board is asking the U.S. Supreme Court to stop the enforcement of an appeals court ruling that ordered the district to allow trans student Gavin Grimm to use campus restrooms based on his gender identity. The school's policy now says that students must use the facilities that reflect their biological gender. Lawyers for the board asked Chief Justice John Roberts this week to issue a stay while they appeal the ruling. If their request is granted, the biological gender bathroom rule would remain in force when Grimm begins the school year in September.
But finally, California's Board of Education has made it the first U.S. state to include LGBT history and culture in public school instruction. It will begin at the elementary school level and continue through middle school and high school. The updated History and Social Science Framework announced on July 14th includes suggested instruction on major LGBT historical figures, important milestones in the struggle for equality, and the evolving character of LGBT communities and identities. Each school district will determine the specific content for their students. The changes stem from passage of the Fair, Accurate, Inclusive, and Respectful Education Act of 2012, which called for important contributions by LGBT Americans and people with disabilities to no longer be excluded from history education. Implementation was delayed by lawsuits filed by right-wing legal groups trying to overturn it. Melissa Goodman, director of the ACLU of Southern California's LGBTQ Gender and Reproductive Justice Project, said in a statement that, "Today, California has taken yet another step to affirm our shared values of inclusivity and fairness."
That's News Wrap for the week ending July 16th, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Jessica Andrea.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
Leftover love heats up in the California desert later in the program. Trans activist Barbara Satin is the National LGBTQ Task Force's Assistant Faith Work Director and a former member of the United Church of Christ's Executive Council. Satin told This Way Out correspondents Dixie Trichel and John Townsend how she recently added an Obama administration position to her credits.
The president wanted me to apply for the Advisory Council on Faith-Based and Neighborhood Initiatives, and I got it. It started basically in the Bush administration, and it was a way in which they were going to, you know, funnel some of the federal money into the faith-based area. The first iteration tried to do a lot of programs and got some things done. The second iteration focused on sex trafficking. We're the third iteration. We're working on poverty issues. And primarily it's, since this is the close of President Obama's time in office, with a Congress that doesn't seem to want to do anything around social action, the idea is, what are some of the things that in the area of poverty that the administration should focus on and get some action going? So I'm coming in sort of at the last portion of this. The group has been meeting for a while. Myself and two other people were just added to the council. My role is going to be, where can I make some additions to that, some help to that? I'm just excited to be a part of it. It's just really important for the trans community at this particular point in time to have that kind of visibility. I think it's really exciting.
You've been very active in housing for queer seniors. Do you think this was part of what spurred people to discover that you were someone who had been an asset to this?
I think that's probably the stimulus to the invitation. I was a presenter at the White House Conference on Senior Housing a year ago, and then I was a delegate to the White House Conference on Aging. For the first time in all of the years that the White House Conference on Aging has been going on, they finally invited the queer community. So I was invited to be one of the three delegates. So I think that had something to do with it. And that's one of the issues that's being addressed, but it's being addressed primarily on the element of youth housing, which is very important, sure. But there's not a lot being said about senior housing, and particularly senior affordable housing.
Can you tell us in general what the task force is about?
The task force is an LGBTQ activist group that really is a national organization that works in the communities. We go where organizations that are basically local or state-based ask us to come in and help them, where we think we have some resources in training or other even financial resources where we can help. In fact, some of our staff are in Orlando, and we went there because Florida Equality said, you know, this is overwhelming to us, and we're not prepared for this. Can you come and give us some support, some help? some exciting and really powerful things are coming out of this. Even in the faith-based area, I was listening to one of the staff say that she, as a black lesbian, was asked to go to a gathering of black churches, conservative churches, and asked to talk about life experience, lived experience that black LGBT people face. And at the end, one of the preachers got up and said, "We have to rethink our theology." That's words you'd never hear out of, you know, the AME and others. So it's really exciting that people are beginning to see who we are and see the lives that we've had to live and are willing to at least understand a little bit about who we are. Be strong and be confident that there will be good that we will do that will come out of this that I think will shape and reshape what the culture is around LGBT equality.
Barbara Satin is the newest member of President Obama's Advisory Council on Faith-Based Neighborhood Partnerships. She was interviewed by Dixie Trichel and John Townsend.
This is Bishop Gene Robinson, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine.
Do you have any idea how long I searched for you, Alex?
When I got your email, I thought, how dare he contact me after all these years? But I had to see you.
I needed to see you too. What do you want?
What do I want?
Yeah, it's a simple question. What do you want?
That is not a simple question.
Lazy Eye is the new Tim Kirkman movie that transported OutFest attendees from the Los Angeles LGBT Film Festival to the scenic California desert retreat of Joshua Tree with a story about long-separated lovers. It's not all romance. It's about life questions that This Way Out's Abby Dees and Wenzel Jones raised in their chat with the writer-director.
Growing older is something we're starting to see more stories of reflected back at us. This film isn't explicitly about that, but that was sort of the first thing that I noticed about it. And I wonder if that was something that was on your mind.
Yeah, it was very much on my mind. I mean, there were two things that really were, I would say, the engine behind the story. And one of them was the challenges of getting a little older. I remember turning 40 and my eyes changing dramatically, and that was a big thing. And it's just sort of like that period in your life when you're looking back at all the choices that you've made and thinking, like, I have some time left, hopefully, you know, and maybe did I make the right choices? And the other thing was this is my fourth film at OutFest. And the first one was Dear Jesse, which was a documentary, and then The Night Larry Kramer Kissed Me, which was a performance film. Mm-hmm. Then Loggerheads, which was a film about a gay adoptee looking for his parents, who is also HIV positive. And with Lazy Eye, I wanted to make a film that had LGBT characters where being queer was not the obstacle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so this was the first time that I'd ever attempted that. So it's about aging, very much, you know, about being middle aged.
They're not that old, are they?
They're not, actually.
But they've changed.
It's approaching middle age. And that's why the eye thing was so critical for me, because it was like, oh, bifocals. Great. Okay.
And if you were under 45, you do not know what we're talking about.
But you will.
But you will.
Yeah.
But you will. So, and of course, go ahead.
So we don't reveal too much. How would you describe the story?
Lazy Eye is about two guys who met in New York City 15 years ago and can reconnect for the first time in 15 years for a weekend in Joshua Tree. You know, it's about so many things. It's about memory. It's about how we remember things. It's about stories. Mm-hmm. It's about how you create stories in order to cope.
Yeah.
Or you know, think about your past and you write a narrative so that mm-hmm. it makes more sense, so that you justify the choices that you've made. And then there's somebody who throws that mirror in front mm-hmm. of you and says, that's not what happened. This is, you know, that's not the memory at all. This is what happened. And so then you have to rewrite it, and that can be pretty uncomfortable.
Do you remember our first actual date? You took me to see this awful movie downtown.
Awful?
Yeah. I was at some artsy theater on Houston about this young boy who falls in love with an old lady.
You don't mean Harold and Maude?
Yes. Oh, my God. That film. I just remember thinking to myself, why is this guy taking me to see this?
Okay, stop talking, please.
No, I mean, it was so sad. and weird and pretentious.
I am holding a knife here.
And then the Cat Stevens music.
Seriously? Stop. Harold and Maude is my favorite movie of all time.
It's everybody's favorite movie. And I noticed in Dean's office you had mock-ups, and one of those was Harold and Maude.
Yep. Yes.
Well played, Harold sir.
Harold and Maude. I'm glad to – thank you for noticing, I'm going to say.
I was also curious, if you were sort of also bringing in that anxiety that I know a lot of gay men have around sort of turning 40, sort of making peace with that.
It's not something that I was thinking about very much. Actually, I was really thinking more about the universal aspects of it, mostly because I think it was so – when I was confronting it, it was so medical. It was because I have amblyopia as well. I also used to be a graphic designer, and there's some other parallels in the movie. But the thing that if you have amblyopia, that hits you a little bit earlier.
And amblyopia is?
It's a lazy eye.
Yes.
Lazy eye is the slang for amblyopia.
That was a big deal when I was a little kid, and I haven't heard that term since for decades. And then I saw this movie. I thought, wow, lazy eye's back.
But it was actually more about the universal aspects of life choices more than anything. And so the externalized part of it, which is – his eyes have changed. So what else do I need? My vision is changing. How do I need to adjust? You know, that kind of story.
Not to put too fine a point on it, but I also – in the lazy of the lazy eye, does that – what does that mean to you? Like
– I don't know. I just feel like I was writing from a very personal place when I was writing Dean, especially with who he was.
Right.
Well, you're not an artist anymore. You're a graphic designer. Okay, well, I'm not a democratic socialist anymore. Now I have two houses. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like what are sort of the compromises that you make? And I associate the term lazy with becoming complacent, becoming the kind of the person who was an activist lying in the streets in 1990, you know, in New York City. And then realizing like, well, do I really have time to go to that protest? It's not someone who doesn't care anymore. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's someone who's gotten comfortable. And it's also a luxury to be able to do that. Like we could all say like, oh, this is first world problems, right? This is not a movie about Syrian refugees. But it's also it's a privilege. It's sort of a luxury to be able to be self-reflexive at all.
The movie is more than two people talking, but a great deal of it is two people talking. And as the director, how do you keep that from just going flat? Because it doesn't, but I realize that's not an easy thing to do.
I think you hire great actors. And I think you hire actors who are compelling to watch and who are interesting to watch. And you work with a cinematographer and an editor and a costume designer and a production designer who help make it come alive. And I had an abundance of that.
And I love that actress who played the workplace psychic,
Michaela Watkins.
That woman is so funny.
Yeah, she's wonderful. She's wonderful. And, you know, such like a throwaway role. She came in for a day. But it's a critical role narratively, you know, because she's the reason that we kind of connect with him.
But did you read a lot of pairs together or did you just like these two people so much?
The actors are Lucas Neer Verbrugge and Aaron Costaganis, and they're both wonderful actors who are out of Tisch, you know, School of the Arts at NYU. They're both seasoned theater actors who are really great looking, and they have a lot of charisma, and they take what they do very seriously.
You know, most of my clients want something safe. They want something traditional. Two heads in the sky, something like that.
Wait, what's two heads in the sky?
You know, you've seen it before. Big faces of the movie stars over a landscape. It's just so boring.
Okay, but aren't those movies usually boring?
Yes, but the poster doesn't have to be.
Oh.
I tell my clients, if we can distill the movie down to its essence and tell the story in a single image, then people actually have to engage with the poster. They have to interact with it. And, hey, maybe it'll make them want to go see the movie more, you know?
No, what does the client say?
They say, great, now let's put two heads in the sky. Which I do because I'm a tool. I know I shouldn't care about this. It's just a stupid poster, but, you know, still, it's...
No, that's great. That is the guy that I remember.
What, crazy?
No. Passionate.
Do you know that coyotes only mate once a year?
I wonder why they sound so sad.
So, what's next in the pipeline?
I have written a script about Lyndon Johnson's chief of staff, Walter Jenkins, and I'm really excited about this.
And why do we need to hear this story?
Because Walter was arrested for having sex with another man in a public restroom.
Now I'm fascinated.
3 weeks before the Goldwater LBJ election, and he was a married father of six, Catholic, and was one of the most beloved and important and powerful and respected people in Washington whose life was ruined and who's part of LGBT history and deserves his narrative to be told.
How do we find out what you're up to?
TimKirkman.com.
Okay, TimKirkman.com. Thank you, Tim Kirkman.
Thank you so much for coming out.
Thank you. It's so fun
to meet these people after you've seen the movie. It's like, oh, real people did that.
Wenzel Jones and Abby Dees spoke with Tim Kirkman, the real person who wrote and directed Lazy Eye.
Ask the gays, who's your friend, Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton? You tell me. You tell me.
The people who know me well know I'm a pretty basic guy. I'm a Christian, a conservative, and a Republican in that order.
When prospective Republican U.S. presidential nominee Donald Trump asked voters to ask the gays at a rally last month, he had not made rabidly homophobic Indiana Governor Mike Pence his running mate. Just over a year ago, Pence ruined his own rumored presidential aspirations by enthusiastically signing a so-called religious freedom bill that legalized anti-LGBT discrimination. As corporate condemnation and economic boycotts rained down on the Hoosier state, Pence's fumbled defense of the law became comic fodder for shows like NBC's Late Night with Seth Meyers.
Multiple times, George Stephanopoulos asked the governor if it would be legal for businesses to deny service to a gay couple, and Pence went an impressive offer.
Is Advance America right when they say a florist in Indiana can now refuse to serve a gay couple without fear of punishment?
Well, let me explain.
If a florist in Indiana refuses to serve a gay couple at their wedding, is that legal now in Indiana?
George.
It said it would protect a Christian florist against any kind of punishment. Is that true or not?
George.
Does that mean that Christians who want to refuse service, or people of any other faith who want to refuse service to gays and lesbians, that it's now legal in the state of Indiana? That's a simple yes or no question.
George.
Do you think it should be legal in the state of Indiana to discriminate against gays or lesbians?
George.
Yes or no, should it be legal to discriminate against gays and lesbians?
George.
No one is better at playing yes, no, or George than Governor Mike Pence.
Ask the gays.
Yes, just ask us. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Jessica Andrea, Michael LeBeau, Dixie Trichel and John Townsend, Bishop Gene Robinson, and Abby Dees and Wenzel Jones contributed program material, with thanks as always to Steve Pride. Barbara Streisand performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this show possible. Check out the latest program information and a lot more at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Lucia Chappelle. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KGNU, Boulder, Denver, Fort Collins, Ward, Colorado, 2BAY, Byron Bay, New South Wales, WMBR, Cambridge, Massachusetts, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The decades following World War II were marked by seeming unbridled optimism and Cold War disquiet. One place where this contradictory anxiety and optimism came together was in childhood, how it was viewed and shaped. Particularly, there was a focus on the idea of fostering childhood creativity to keep American children ahead in the race between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. And the means were through mass consumption items that supposedly stimulated the inner creativity of children. As Amy Ogata has written, these concerns shaped schools, playgrounds, the layout of the home, and myriad consumption items directed at children, such as playhouses and toys. She's professor and chair of art history at the University of Southern California, and in Designing the Creative Child, Playthings and Places in Mid-Century America, Ogata situates today's assumptions about childhood creativity that may erroneously appear timeless back to their historical origins. Let me begin by asking you, Amy, about this prevailing assumption about children's inherent creativity. Where does it come from, in fact?
Well, I think that the idea that children are creative, that they are naturally creative, is something that has gained a lot of speed in the 20th century. It's something that is very much apparent in the child rearing literature, in the study of children that develops really forcefully in the years in the 1920s and the 1930s. But then it becomes something that is widely disseminated in the years after World War II. So the idea that children are creative, that they might make these interesting discoveries, is something that psychologists, but also artists, were really interested in the teens and the 20s, but become something manufactured, sold, and then widely studied in the 1950s and 1960s in particular.
Well, I realize it's a hard one to nail down, but how should we even define creativity? What does that mean?
This is such a hard word, and the critic Brendan Gill has called it a word as light and wayward and almost as untetherable as milk down. And I think that is exactly right, because it's a word that we find very difficult to actually define. It is something that is becomes immediately very tautological. It means creativity means the ability to create. And so we're left without very substantial ways of defining it, but it becomes associated strongly with ideas of innovation, with ideas of ingenuity, of new insight, and all of these kind of associations of discovery that get packed into the idea of creativity. It also has connotations of authenticity, that there's something that is inherently pure or unique that it lives in this concept of creativity.
Well, you just said that the idea of children as innately creative really flourished in the 20th century. And I wondered if you could break that down a bit and talk about, first, the changes in academic views about child development in the early 20th century, moving away from some more rigid notions around education and the capacities of children. What shifted and how did it shift?
In the early 20th century, there are some really interesting educational models, and particularly designs for schools that are accompanying specific programs, curricular programs. And these are pioneering efforts. They are the kinds of things that are not mainstream at all. They are very much, you know, a kind of conversation between an educator or school district and a designer. And so the idea that children are creative, that this is something that can be enhanced through education, it becomes palpable in the early 20th century, and particularly among émigrés from Europe. So this idea of studying children, looking at their artwork, thinking about how they think, some of their insights, are ideas that become interesting to designers and to educators, and they begin to develop specific kinds of schools, specific kinds of learning environments, specific kinds of art education programs to foster these insights, right? To instead of mainstream the idea of being a good citizen, but rather to look for some of these more exceptional talents that they see as really interesting and promising. And again, this is something that is very small scale in the early 20th century, but becomes something that is much more widespread after World War II. And it happens gradually over time, but there are some very high profile examples in the United States in particular. There are a couple of really important models that become highly publicized. So one example would be the Crow Island School that was built in Winnetka, Illinois, it's in the Chicago suburbs, between 1939 and 1940, so just before World War II. And it's this collaboration, this really complicated, interesting collaboration between a specific kind of educational outlook and educational ideal that is designed really in concert with the local school district and the architects. And the architects are Eliel Saarinen, who's a Finnish emigre, comes to the United States in the 20s and 30s. And this project becomes something that really flourishes as a result of this very unique collaboration that happens between a set of educational ideals, but also then some very willing and interesting designers.
Well, in thinking about how children are viewed in society, obviously there are all sorts of anxieties and differences to do with class and race that get also projected onto children. One of the things that I found very interesting in your book is shifting views from the late 19th century through the early 20th century about early childhood education with different classes of children in mind. So the kindergarten, the notion of the kindergarten, right, which comes from Europe, being focused on poorer children, and then the emergence of the idea of the nursery school amongst progressive looking educators, nursery school, of course, preceding kindergarten, for a different class of children. How did that develop, and what were the origins of the concerns around these two schools, which, again, sort of come down to us as something almost natural, that
children might go to a preschool, that they would go to kindergarten and these would be beneficial for them.
Absolutely. This the kindergarten models, when it's developed in Europe, in Germany, in the late 1830s and 1840s. And when it comes to the U.S. in the late 19th century, it is implemented as a way of helping poor families, as a way of teaching children who might not have some of these advantages, as a way of instilling certain kinds of habits and a kind of knowledge. So it's very different from the way it's theorized in the 19th century. And kindergarten, of course, we now understand as a very standardized, step in the educational process, and particularly in the United States. But it was something that was introduced at the end of the 19th century. The preschool, the idea of nursery school in particular, is something that in the 20s and 30s was very rare and very much the province of an elite, progressive person or family who was interested in particular scientific views of what we would call the child study movement. So they were fairly rare. And the idea that preschool is something normal, which we now live with, is something that really developed strongly in these years just after World War II. And one of the reasons for this is the shifts that are taking place in labor during wartime, when there are new possibilities for preschool, for working mothers, for example, who might be going off to factory jobs. Some of these programs continue on. Many of them do not at all. And they get reinvented in new ways. There's a whole literature, interesting literature, on collaborative child rearing preschools that people built in their own homes, in their own neighborhoods, where people are creating kind of co-ops of watch your children, you watch mine, but let's do something with them during this time. And that's something that happens very ad hoc in the 40s and early 50s. The idea of preschool as something normal, as something expected, develops in part because of the tremendous influx of new births. So the book is very much about the baby boom, which was this massive rise in live births that happened in the United States between 1946 and 1964, and resulted in nearly 80 million new children who came on the scene very quickly. So 4 million a year, every year, between 1954 and 1964 alone. So the pressure that all of these new children are putting on the institutions that exist are really exacerbating some of these kind of growing trends that are developing gradually but become very immediate concerns in these years after World War II.
Right, and you argue, Amy Ogata, in your book, Designing the Creative Child, Playthings and Places in Mid-Century America, that these social changes that followed World War II especially really shaped ideas which in many ways have come to us as seeming natural, and you're really placing them in their historical situation. And of course, that situation was, as you just mentioned, one of enormous increase in the number of children being born following World War II. It was also a period, especially for white middle-class families, of increasing affluence. And it was a period which, in some contradictory way, was simultaneously a period of great optimism, but also anxieties. Can you expand on that contradictory aspect of this period?
Yes, this is a period in which there is this tremendous optimism after the end of the war, and part of that is we understand that historically as this rise, this demographic rise in the number of new children born. But it's also obviously a moment of tremendous anxiety about geopolitics and about this phenomenon that we call the Cold War, and the kind of sense of potential catastrophe that might at any moment befall this nation newly, you know, emerged from wartime anxieties. So there's this lingering cloud of war, this is kind of compounded by this sense of fear that is very much part of the experience of the Cold War. And so while we're looking, when we look back, I think, at these post-war years, it's very easy to see them as a kind of really innocent moment, as this moment of tremendous economic growth, of the rise of real wages. But it's also a moment that is very much self-critical. And it's also a moment that is very much defined by some of these larger external political concerns that are weighing very heavily on everyday people. It's also a moment of tremendous growing strife in terms of race and class. And this is the part of the post-war era that we tend not to focus on. I think there's been much more scholarship on it in the last 10 years, but it is something that the kind of rosy view of the post-war era in the U.S. Is really dogged and shadowed by the internal politics in the U.S., but also this external force that is wielding tremendous pressure.
And also, of course, war, even if it doesn't take place on the soil of the country, it certainly didn't take place on U.S. soil.
Right.
But yeah. War does upend all sorts of traditional hierarchies, including gender roles. Was there some way that in the post-war period, shifts that may have happened during the war then were reflected in visions of the family, visions of childhood, visions of motherhood?
There is a very interesting conversation, particularly among experts, and by experts I mean pediatricians, doctors, psychologists who become vocal and whose views are repeated constantly in popular magazines. And there's this perception that the structure of the family itself is something that should be thought of as an important dimension of the larger politics of the era. And the Yale psychologist Arnold Gazelle suggests that a totalitarian model of family life, where there's a strong father who is the powerful figure in the family structure, the family unit, is a dangerous one. And so argues strongly that the family should be something more democratic, that democracy begins in the household, and that children should be part of this entity in a way, giving them new power, a new kind of agency in the family unit itself. And I think we see this in the ways in which the house is redesigned in the years after World War II. This is obviously a moment of tremendous building efforts on the part of merchant builders who are creating these vast tracts of suburbia. It's also a time when there are some very high-profile architects who are building model houses. And one of the features is the playroom. And so this kind of new emphasis on giving children their own space in the household is something that becomes a kind of new norm. It was something that was certainly available to elite children in the 19th century, the early 20th century. But it's something that becomes a kind of staple of this child-centered life, particularly in suburbia. This is the ways in which suburbia is sold to young families, that it's better for the children. They would have a place to play both outside in these suburban environments, but also inside in their own playroom. And so there are various museums, the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis, the Museum of Modern Art in New York City, that stage these model houses in which the playroom is a kind of a new space that gains tremendous attention. People are certainly interested in the ways that the kitchen is arranged. They're interested in the ways in which the social spaces are presented. But there is a kind of fixation on the play areas and the ways in which they're related to these other spaces in the house. And I think that tells us something about the power of children, the perceived power and needs that children have within the family unit.
That is the voice of art historian Amy Ogata. We're speaking about her book, Designing the Creative Child, Playthings and Places in Mid-Century America. That book is published by the University of Minnesota Press. And you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. So we're going to talk a whole lot more in the course of this hour about the many ways that this post-war emphasis on childhood creativity emerged, took form in the built environment of houses, in schools, in playgrounds, and the toys that children were encouraged to have, to be bought. But before we delve deeper into that, I want to ask you about just this general notion of childhood creativity. It sounds like what you're describing is a shift toward what may be termed a kind of more humanist view of children, that this could be considered maybe a progressive move in terms of understanding children, moving away from some of the rigid patriarchal notions of the past. But do you actually see there's something wrong with this basic premise about the innate creativity of children that is embedded in all of these ideas?
I think that this is precisely the problem that I was trying to explore in the book, was to think about the ways in which we assume so much about children and their growth, their development, their insights, and it's particularly this dynamic between the adult and the child, right? So this idea that the child is innately creative, and there are many psychological researchers who are fascinated with this notion, and they begin to study it in a very intense way after about 1950. And it is started off by the new president of the American Psychological Association, who J.P. Guilford, who is inaugurated in 1950, and his inaugural address is precisely about creativity and the ways in which it hasn't yet been studied, hasn't yet been given its due. This initiates this tremendous onslaught of interest in children's creativity and the idea that children were naturally creative and that they lost this creativity over time as they went through the process of maturation, through the schooling process, that they became uncreative, that they suddenly became adults who no longer had access to these insights, to this originality, to this authenticity. And all of these questions are lingering ones in the 50s and 60s, because this is precisely a moment of tremendous anxiety and tremendous self-questioning about the conformity of American society. So the idea that children are naturally creative was something very much assumed, but it was also put to a test in several instances. There are a whole battery of tests that are developed to measure creativity. One of the most important one was developed by E. Paul Torrance in the early 1960s, and it's still a test that's given today to test, to ask children to examine problems in fluency, to test originality, to look at their verbal and nonverbal activities, to think about both divergent and convergent thinking. Some of these ideas, this attempt to quantify creativity on the part of researchers in the post-war era is something that has not stopped in the course of the 20th and 21st centuries. But there's also a tremendously interesting amount of research about the idea of creativity and its relationship to giftedness. There are researchers who are thinking about what is this relationship? Are smarter, those who have more aptitude in taking tests, naturally creative or not creative. And so, again, this is all part of an attempt to try to harness creativity, to figure out what it is, and to think about how it can be perpetuated into adulthood.
One statistic that you mention in your book, which was very striking about this period, was that between 1945 and 1950, consumer spending rose 60% in the U.S., and spending on household items increased a whopping 240%. Now, obviously, this is coming out of the more limited consumption of the war years, but still, those are enormous increases. How did that intersect with these theories about objects and environments helping children's development and the development of their creativity?
There are certainly more available dollars to spend, and there is a growing perception that children have needs and that we recognize this by giving them things of their own size, their own furniture, their own certain kind of spoons and plates and bowls and things like that. And so there is a growth in real wages, for sure. There is a tremendous amount of spending that is lavished on children that is indicative of a kind of reassessment after the war years. And you're right that it is in contrast to these much leaner years that this seems to just mushroom in this way. There is also the growth of these kinds of businesses that are pitching to parents that their children should have certain kinds of toys, that we might think about needing new kinds of garments, something like this plastic diaper cover that is invented in 1950 and is something that is tremendously popular. Now, obviously, children were wearing diapers for many years before the post-war era, but suddenly the idea that you need things for your children becomes something that is taken up very widely and really is a force in the American economy. And the manufacturers of objects for children, and probably the most prominent of these manufacturers are the toy manufacturers, are very keen to tell parents that they should be providing their children with a certain kind of stimulation and that they should be buying toys, not just at holidays, which had traditionally been the great moments of consumption around toys, but to tell them that they needed to provide these things to their children year-round if they wanted them to become well-adjusted, good citizens who were being stimulated in these appropriate and correct ways. So the toy manufacturers are very sad about the availability of parents, the parents' willingness to spend on their children, and they begin to pitch their objects to specific ages, really dividing up the toys that are appropriate for children at certain ages, and also educational toys, not these kinds of novelties that might be really popular around the holidays, but this kind of investment in the household, the investment in the child that the educational toy represents.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with the author of Designing the Creative Child, Playthings and Places in Mid-Century America. It's published by the University of Minnesota Press, and its author is Amy Ogata. She is professor and chair of art history at the University of Southern California. We're talking about the push for childhood creativity in the post-war period, ideas which seem to be still very deeply with us. I wonder if you could talk about some of the iconic toys of the era we're talking about following World War II and how they were supposed to encourage creativity in children.
Well, probably the most iconic toys of the post-war era are not part of this discourse. So toys like the hula hoop, toys like Barbie, are probably the ones that most listeners would associate with this moment. But there is a whole genre of toys that developed in this moment, in tandem with this conversation about promoting creativity in children, that some of which, you know, still exist today. The House of Cards, which was designed by Charles and Ray Eames in 1952 and came originally in three different sizes, is one of these objects that had flourished on the market and then was reintroduced, and it's still available today by a different manufacturer. But it was part of this genre of toys that were designed by artists and architects, professional designers, rather than these big toy manufacturers, that stands for a kind of openness in the design of playthings. So the House of Cards is a series of kind of cardboard, stiff cardboard rectangles with rounded corners that have six slots. And you can reposition these cards in various ways, in a kind of modular way. And you can build them, you can expand these structures that can be assembled with this object in a whole variety of ways. And this is an object that is very much typical in the sense that it doesn't have instructions, or if there are instructions, they are really just a starting point. There was a toy that was developed by the Walker Art Center called Magna Master. It was very short-lived. It was really an immediate post-war project. It was a project that was created by an architect named Arthur Carrara, along with Daniel Deffenbacher, who was at the time the director of the Walker Art Museum. And he also was an architect. And they're very much interested in the ways in which design as an activity, an open activity, a creative activity, is something that was a kind of natural way to garner children's interest and to seize upon objects as a way of enhancing some of these instincts that they saw as very natural. And so they developed this toy called Magnet Master that was a series of metal plates that could be put together with L-nickel magnets. So this is a kind of very strong magnet that holds these plates in place. And they create this set, and they market it as a new creative toy, as something that has no instructions, because children are naturally creative and they will naturally create their own interesting objects from this kit of parts. And so the kinds of toys that I discuss in the book are really kits. They are the kinds of toys that don't have instructions or models to build, but really emphasize the child's agency in thinking about how they want to use these materials. There are other toys by designers, a set of Flexagons, as they were called, that were designed by a Seattle architect, Fred Bassetti. And these are simple little cardboard cutouts, again, that could be assembled with a series of rubber bands. And the idea is using these kinds of ordinary materials, things like, you know, magnets or cardboard, to allow children to develop their own playthings, in a sense. One of the reference for these kinds of open toys is the cardboard box. And this is a toy that, of course, is certainly not one that's necessarily manufactured for children. It's a kind of ready-made, all right. But it's one that is always referred to as, well, if you don't have the money to build a playhouse, just get your kids a cardboard box. Or using cardboard, using these kinds of disposable materials that allow children to impose their own will upon the materials and upon these kinds of forms.
Well, you just mentioned the playhouse, and that is one concept, I guess, that took different forms that was important in this post-war emphasis on childhood creativity, whether it was a playhouse inside or a house in the backyard for children. Why playhouses? What sort of significance did they have in terms of allowing children to have a particular kind of creative play?
The playhouse is an object that certainly predates the post-war era. And it is one that was available to elite families. So there's these tremendous little miniature houses that were built on elite estates in the late 19th century and early 20th century. What happens to them is that they become consumable by middle-class families in the era after World War II. And instead of having working kitchens where children are allowed to, you know, bake their own bread and make their own soup, which was the case in these very lavish examples before the war, the examples that develop after World War II are really open again, like some of these toys. They are often a simple draping of a card table, or a cardboard box, or these easy to assemble temporary spaces that can be set up both indoors and outdoors. And the idea, of course, of the house as giving children their own space is something that is very much tied to this fixation on housing in the post-war era. And this is obviously a moment when there's a huge conversation that is happening around giving children their own space in suburbia, of families wanting to have their own space. And for the first time, they're able to buy a house of their own. And so this is really extended to children in the family. Children themselves are given their own little miniature houses. But really distinguishes them is that they are for pretend, right? That by giving children a playhouse, part of the idea is to give them a space that's separate from the adult world in which they can invent their own games, their own characters, their own fantasies in this space. And it's so the blankness, I think, of the post-war playhouse is one that is encouraged as a way of stimulating their creativity, as a way of suggesting to them that play on their own apart from adults. But again, this is something that is manufactured and assembled and offered to children by adults is the expectation that they are going to have this very vivid interior life in these miniature domestic spaces.
My name is Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm speaking with Amy Ogata, art historian and author of Designing the Creative Child. What about the design of schools? You've mentioned the design of houses, how creative living was shaped in the post-war era, and notions about children's toys and environments domestically. How did these ideas around expanding, nurturing children's creativity take place in the classroom?
But this is a huge subject that really preoccupied Americans at the end of World War II and throughout the post-war era because of the surge of new children and some of the population shifts that had taken place. So entire suburban tracts that are developed. There is a tremendous need for new schools. That is something that is very, very pressing. And there's a kind of panic about the fact that they haven't been building schools during the Depression, haven't been maintaining schools, and that educational ideals have also changed since this era. So there's this a kind of convergence of the pressure of all of these new children looking for seats in classrooms and not enough classrooms or classrooms that are perceived as outdated. And so there is this resurgence in the attention to education and particularly to elementary and high school education that becomes something that is discussed very widely. It's discussed among professional educators. It's discussed among architects and urban planners. It is also very prominent in popular magazines like Life and Collier's and Ladies' Home Journal that are, again, taking up an idea that is pervasive in this moment. And The pressure on schools is only heightened after the launch of two Soviet satellites, Sputnik 1 and 2, in 1957. And the American government passes the National Defense Education Act in 1958. And this allows for a dramatic influx of federal funding into education. It allows for federal funds for school building. It allows for the development of new programs in science and foreign languages, and is very much a response to these Cold War pressures that are being felt in the realm of education. And there is a concerted effort to build new schools. So not only is there this pressure to find seats for children, there's a pressure to rethink the school plant itself, to ask, what do we need in this new era? And it is perceived as an era in which there is tremendous change and new values that are being put on educating children in particular. And this is very much in dialogue with the idea of progressivism and progressive education in particular. And this is kind of a moment of critique as well. Historians of education really debate this question of how influential progressive education was. And the consensus is that it was an idea that had very lingering effects, that in practice it was not implemented necessarily in the ways that some of the great theorists of progressive education would have perhaps wanted to see. But one point that I make is that for architects and for designers, the ideas around progressivism are absolutely resurgent in the ways that they are rethinking the school itself. So they're interested in some of these technical questions around how do we light our schools? How do we increase airflow? How do we think about making an optimal environment for children to learn in? But they're also asking these really interesting questions around how do we instill some of these individual values? How do we make democracy understood in the classroom itself? How do we encourage children's creativity? So the pressures to not just build a whole bunch of schools, lots of classrooms all at once, but also to really rethink, what is this curriculum doing? How are children responding? And what are the ways in which the physical, material aspects of the school can enhance some of these experiences and these lessons.
So how did these ideas about reshaping schools extend to other environments, such as the playground?
Yes. So the ways in which the school plant changes is that it becomes largely one story, open to the outdoors, open to areas for children to play. And so the playground is a kind of immediate, really adjacent figure, space in this larger question. But because cities are undergoing tremendous change at this moment, there are many new playgrounds that are being planned, not just for school plants and campuses, but really for communities. And they are rethinking what it is, what are these spaces, and trying to shift some of the conversation around how children play to into different kinds of registers. So the idea of the playground is one from the late 19th century, from the progressive era, and it develops in a kind of standardized ways in which there are swing sets, there are jungle gyms to climb on, there might be a seesaw, and many of these are just repeated over and over and over again. Again, you know, really standardized equipment. And there is a move in the early 50s to reconsider the playground, to ask it to do different things for children, to let children take the lead instead of lining up and waiting for turns on the swings. These are playgrounds that are designed to give everybody an opportunity to play simultaneously, to think about making their own spaces, using these aspects that can be reconfigured by children, so allowing them to be the designers of their own environment to a certain extent. There was a high-profile exhibition and competition for new playground equipment that was sponsored by the toy manufacturer Creative Playthings. And it was co-sponsored with the Museum of Modern Art in New York City. And it gave three designs high prominence. And these were designs that allowed children to exercise their bodies, to have hiding places. They were designs that were easy to manufacture, that could be repeated in various configurations. But they were very much designed in contrast to the idea of a conventional swing set or jungle gym. They were looking much more towards sculpture and to some of the ideas that are that were being conceived in Europe, and particularly by Scandinavian designers who are thinking about play structures as sculptural elements. And so there's a concerted effort to, again, incorporate architects, designers, and artists into the conversation about what the playground is, who is using it, and how it looks in relationship to the built environment that is changing really substantially in this period after World War II. The playground becomes a site of regeneration, and it becomes a site of liberation. But it's liberation not just of, you know, physical energy, but it also becomes a place where aesthetic lessons can also take hold. And so thinking about the way the playground looks, the design of it, the aesthetics of it, the ways in which it encourages a child's agency and creativity were all parts of the ways in which the playground was rethought in the period after World War II. And it's really the era of the mid-50s to the very early 1970s.
The Children's Museum also came into its own in the post-war era, driven by concerns about nurturing childhood creativity. How did the kinds of children's museums that were shaped at that time set out to cultivate the creativity of American children after World War II?
The Children's Museum is an invention of the turn of the century, from 1900, and the first one of the first children's museums is the Brooklyn Children's Museum, which was devised as a place for children to have after-school programs, to engage in nature study. And so the Children's Museum is an established type before the war, but it becomes something much more popular. And even existing museums are redesigning their children's quarters as a way of engaging new visitors. So major art museums like the Metropolitan Museum of Art or the Art Institute of Chicago are giving new attention to areas specifically for children and devising exhibits and libraries and galleries that are specifically for children. There are also children's museums, new museums that are being built that are specifically for children themselves. This is an explosion of children's museums that happens after World War II. And they become places for children to explore. And the Brooklyn Children's Museum is a great example because it is renovated dramatically, in fact, rebuilt in the late 1960s. And the plan is completely different from the structure that existed before then. And it is devised with different areas for children to explore, for children to find things of their own interest, to play with machines, to figure out how windmills work, to mix soils in a planting station, to figure out how to refine grain that is milled, and to explore quite sophisticated questions around waves, ripple tanks, these kinds of ideas that are being explored in secondary science classrooms as well. So some of these ideas around science that are being rethought in the post-war era are available in children's museums as well as in kind of high school science curriculum.
I wanted to end by asking you why you think it is that these ideas about the innate yet cultivatable creativity of children have become so standard today. You talk about the context in which these ideas took shape following World War II. The times we live in now are quite different with different sets of concerns. So why is it that these notions about childhood creativity and the importance of fostering it are so absolutely standard? Is it because they're right? Is it because there are a different set of anxieties, but they fit in with those post-war ones? Is it that those ideas were just so immensely powerful that they've shaped everything that came after it?
I think that they were tremendously powerful. And I think that this kind of ready consumption of creativity through, you know, the purchasing of special kinds of toys that were understood as open-ended, that allowed a child to participate in the playing process, were something that has proved commodifiable, right? So there is a huge market for children's goods today, just as there was in the late 50s and early 60s. And many of these same discourses are extremely familiar, and they are repackaged in a sense. So you could go into any of these big box stores and see aisles of what are called creativity toys. And they are all kinds of objects. They tend not to be these kinds of arty designer toys. They tend to be things like crayons and kits. And so there is certainly a rhetoric of creativity that I think we tend to see in very limited terms, but we still very much associate with children. We see the idea that children can manipulate objects in ways that are unconventional and maybe unanticipated. And so certainly manufacturers have been very savvy about using that rhetoric to promote the things that they sell, even if they are things like taking a sticker off of, you know, one page and putting it on another page. The promise of enhancing creativity is something that is everywhere in goods for children, but certainly, as you suggest, it's also very much in our world for adults as well. And so the idea of creativity as something that is going to save us, that's going to save our economy, that is going to allow us to compete in a global environment, these are all the sometimes unsaid and sometimes quite obviously stated promises that creativity seems to offer to us. I think we are in a moment of tremendous anxiety about our place in the world. It's a different kind of geopolitical question than the one that faced people in the 50s and 60s and 70s, but it is still very much a part of the world that we live in. And it is something that has become naturalized in business in particular. And so the idea that creativity is the thing that's going to help your business, that's going to make money, that's going to be the new idea, that's going to be the sensation, it's going to be the thing that is going to save the country is a refrain that is not uncommon in our own era.
I've been speaking with the author of Designing the Creative Child, Playthings and Places in Mid-Century America. That's published by the University of Minnesota Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Amy Ogata is professor and chair of art history at the University of Southern California. Her other books include Swedish Wooden Toys. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
Greetings from Fitzpatrick's Pub in Curitiba, Brazil. I'm here in one of the most important points in the Irish network in Brazil, and indeed probably in all of Latin America, with the owner of the bar, the Ilan Piper, and traditional music, folk Irish music player, Luis Fitzpatrick. Luis, can you tell us about the adventures today here in Curitiba?
Yeah, sure. The event today was a great, great occasion, because we meet four bands of traditional music bands, and we had a great, great Irish traditional session with music in a bus, in a touristic bus, with the peoples of Brazil. Was great, great. With Ilan Pipe, Irish flute, boron, and all the traditional instruments here in my city. Was fantastic stuff, fantastic.
Very good. And can you explain why are these events happening today, the celebrations, why is this year important?
Yeah, because we celebrate the Easter Rising, 100 years of the Republic of Ireland, and we explained to the people the symbol, for example, of the Ilan Pipe, like a most important instrument to Ireland, and the day like a very important date, because my grandfather died in 1918 in the war to the conquest the independence, you know.
And from that, you've a very strong love of the Irish culture, that this huge side of your own family, no? Your grandparents from Dublin, and you're celebrating your culture and sharing it with more people here in Brazil. And how do Brazil people, what's their reaction when they hear the music and they start learning about the Irish culture and more, and also the history?
The reaction was fantastic, because the Irish music is very strong, like a Brazilian music, you know, full of craic and soul, yeah. And the reaction to the history of the independence is that the people was impressive, you know, because the Irish people is so strong and brave, you know. This is an example to us, you know, here in Brazil.
Very good, very good. And also here with the Irish Bar, it's a place people, they like coming in and having a few pints, drinking a few shoppies, no? Yeah. So more things that we share in common, no?
Yeah, yeah, of course. Here in my pub, all the days, and the people coming to the pub with a full of craic and happiness.
Very good, very good. Well, we'll send this on to our friends back in Ireland and to the Brazilians that are in Ireland and the Irish and rest of America, Latin America, the rest of the world, no? Because we're all one big family, wherever we are, all together, no? So, Gramila Mahagut, thank you very much, and we'll talk to you soon.
Slán leat. Tá faltirúd.